The Monday Morning Tech Chat Show is brought to you by Audible. Audible is, of course, the premier audiobook service, perfect for folks who want their books read to them. Thousands and thousands of titles to choose from in all genres, sci-fi, fantasy, biographies, history, thrillers, mysteries, and more. We've got a great offer for listeners on this podcast, 2 free audiobooks when you sign up. And those books are yours to keep even if you decide to cancel your Audible subscription, which is $14.95 a month and gives you a free book every month of your choosing, as well as some other fun perks. Membership has its privileges. Hit up bit.ly/geekbookclub to start your free trial and get those 2 free books on lock. Once again, bit.ly/geekbookclub. And now, let's get into the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I am your host, Juan Carlos Bagnell, also known as Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this horribly, terribly, truly badly named podcast series. But the QA in SGGQA, of course, stands for question and answer, because I like to make these interactive discussions with an amazing live chat of folks who are already jumping in and throwing some comments around. I've been seeing LFA Reviews, I'm seeing Q3 Becker, Dave Ferns, Sam, 34 Kilometers, Aditya Anil, Gary the Fireman, Peta, Gabaletta, Heike, JMX Warrior, I know I'm missing a few in there as we co-stream, Vazikos 8, I definitely didn't want to miss Vazikos, and Natakun joining a live stream for the first time in a couple months. So I want to say a huge hearty thank you and a shout out to everyone streaming this live. I like to host my tech review and tech news podcast on a Monday because it gives us some time to sort of sort out our feelers from the week before. Maybe some breaking news happened over the weekend, but we can come to Monday morning, get our tech week started off right, and then check in on news stories as they evolve. I like to spend a little time following up on topics, and Monday seems to be the appropriate time to stage a show like that. LeBaron Burton, LB, the Popcorn Man, is streaming this on the Periscopes right now, so everyone give a big hearty thumbs up to LB out there on Periscope. So, folks, where I would normally kind of go through, you know, some lifestyle stuff, you know, like, oh, this is the wacky thing that Lex did, and oh, this is how my wife destroyed another gadget in her purse. Married life. I gotta say, last week was brutal. Last week was a very tough week for me. Not a bad week. This is a very good problem to have as a solo lone wolf gadget reviewer. Obviously, one of the biggest tech stories of the year, the iPhone SE, launched last week. If you remember from last week's podcast, I also had some kind of a bit of a discussion on the OnePlus 8, and I was just talking about my own personal experiences and working with their PR and how I kind of dropped the ball with some of their communications. Well, they sent over OnePlus 8s. So a huge thank you for the support, OnePlus, as I did not want to miss out on talking about these phones. But the global launch of the OnePlus 8 is in 2 days. It's the 29th. And I've got to scramble to get any kind of coverage produced because I'm just getting my hands on the phone. I got them the day before the iPhone SE. So the entire week last week was spent producing content. I don't know that I saw my family that much over the last week. So especially, who was it? Gary the Fireman is saying housekeeping in 14 minutes. I don't know that I can pull off housekeeping in under 15. Last week, you know, I try to tease content as I'm producing it. You know, these are the stories you should look out for. Oh, I got these headphones. I'm going to have a review out on them shortly. Last week was one of those catch up, you know, the dam kind of broke on a bunch of things that I've been trying to put together, things that I've been holding in reserve. And then let me see. I did the show last week. That was around 2 hours, 2 streams at around 2 hours apiece. That's 6 hours AC. That was 7 hours. I did almost 10 hours of podcasting and interviewing last week. So let's jump into some housekeeping. Dave Burns, housekeeping 30 minutes, plus or minus five. I'm going to try and move through this quickly, but there's a lot to cover as somegadgetguy.com had a lot of links go live and a lot of videos went up and there was Newegg production. I mean, it was a pretty heavy week. So let me scroll down on my website. This was an incredibly important story for me, a video for me to produce as a follow-up to a piece of technology that blew me away. And I felt really deserved more conversation. I mean, like a lot of tech outlets kind of played with it when it first launched, and then there wasn't a lot of follow-up. And I was guilty of that, too. I am of course, describing the Focals. This is a heads-up display. These are really? My website just took me to the top of my website. Let's see. Can I? There we go. I'm going to share links as we try and go along. The Focals are an incredible product. I was excited about the Focals when they first launched simply because I wanted to find the evolution of the smartwatch, something that would enable me to handle my phone less, but then also keep me connected to the most important pieces of information. I think smartphones are terrible at notifications. Since the days of the BlackBerry, we make jokes about crackberries, right? You know, that there's this like learned response to react to everything our phone does, and it just kind of blends into the background of our day. But when you separate yourself from that, it's really refreshing. Following up on the Focals today was really exciting because of everything that's going on in the world. I'm going to continue winking about the situation. One of our stories is actually YouTube kind of taking a harder stance on misinformation. And I don't trust the algorithm to not look at my channel mentioning the situation and then banning my content. So I'm not playing any games. I can't really afford to take any risks. But one of the other things I just wanted to point out, I don't have the original up. Ah, dang it. So this right here, when I go full screen on this this video, the thumbnail that I'm using is Photoshopped from my original Focals review. And I was just proud of me because I'm really terrible at Photoshop, but I managed to kind of get the layers and the transitions and the mask under the glasses, and I bent the mask around my face using a warping tool. So I was just really stoked that I pulled off a re-edit of my original thumbnail. But anyway, I absolutely adore the Focals, and we're getting word on Focals Gen 2. So if you're like me and you're looking for something that really does feel futuristic, I would highly recommend checking out what North is up to with the Focals. Okay, next story. This one I'm not going to tease as long. Smartphone camera reviewing is very difficult. Camera comparisons are really tricky to properly kind of explain all of the little nuanced differences between sensor sizes and color science and post-processing. So we're trying to whittle some of that down. I'd like to do more feature-focused comparisons. I really don't see a lot of value in doing phone versus phone and trying to encapsulate the full experience of using a phone camera because they're very different. As much as we try to say, oh, you just push the shutter button and it's auto HDR. That's not really what this means. I want to go hands-on with the Samsung after this most recent update just to talk about pro modes, right? That is a long-form video all by itself. But one of the first that I decided to tackle was a quick look at portrait modes. So looking at the differences between a more software approach on the Pixel 4 and a more hardware-focused approach on the LG V60. So Google software cutting and background blurring against LG's continual brute force hardware approach to solving problems with the binocular depth of time of flight depth sensors. Just some interesting results for me. You know, whether or not you think the video is valuable commentary, I walked away going, huh, I wouldn't have expected that. So you can check out that video, somegadgetguy.com. I'm proud and I am ecstatic. I am excited to announce the return of the semi-regular series of creator chats. long form, chill conversations with people I think are making cool things on the internet. And I could not be more honored to have Jason Howell from All About Android. As Jason, I mean, he let it slip. I'd honestly forgotten how long All About Android had been in production. They're closing in on 10 years. 10 years. They're about to celebrate a decade of production on that podcast. That's incredible. So I bent Jason's ear for about 90 minutes. He was gracious enough to come on, share some thoughts, but just the story of how he got started, how he almost got busted by the FBI as a kid for messing around with computers. I always find that the stories of how people get into this craft are so varied and so dynamic and so different. But his is especially special to me because we share a lot of the same background, only I didn't get up to as much trouble as a kid as he did. But yeah, so Creator Chat's going to be coming back. I'm reaching out to another group of friends. I'm also trying to tap a few more people that, like my mission for the subreddit, Glowing Rectangles. I want to see if there's also more of an opportunity to share stories with people who are coming up in alongside people who I feel have very well-established professional careers with great reputations. So I'm going to be reaching out to some buddies like Joshua Vergara. I still need to DM him. Sorry, Josh, if you see this. I did mean to get to you over the weekend. But, reviewer's going to review, and my weekend got obliterated. But I also want to hit up a couple other players like Viper. I was sort of skulking in the live chat on his last show and realized, like, man, that is such an interesting voice in this tech commentary right now. And the dude is putting out so much energy and so many good vibes, and it's not getting the algorithm love that it should be. He's got a core group of fans. He is reaching out to larger content creators. He is on people's radar. And yet, for some reason, YouTube is not playing up his energy. And that's a shame. I mean, just like this is exactly everything that sucks about algorithmic based manipulation of our content feeds. You want entertainment and you want some interesting gadget commentary. Why shouldn't you be checking out a dude like Viper? Why shouldn't YouTube be fronting that? But it comes off as aggressive, and I think that's one of the reasons why we don't get that voice highlighted in the way that we should. LFA Reviews, absolutely. One of the most underrated creators. Well, you know what, LFA? I need to be doing a better job of putting my money where my mouth is. The Glowing Rectangles and the subreddit and the outreach, that's all well and good. But, if I'm also going to be feuding against YouTube in every podcast I create, this is an opportunity, and it's an opportunity I'm missing. This is a voice I enjoy. Why aren't I doing a better job of highlighting it? So that's also going to become a bigger part of the mission for Creator Chat moving forward. Like I say during the subreddit, you'll hear me say it during the subreddit plug. Right now, anything we can do to support other creators is going to be very well spent energy and very appreciated by the people out there making cool content. I'm preaching to the choir here. If you're a fan of my content and you know who Viper is, there's a really good Venn diagram overlap. That delta, you probably are digging what Viper's making too. Vasico's 8. I don't even prefer Apple, but that dude is awesome. He is. I love that he just came out of the gate, the self-proclaimed captain of Team Apple. He's so good. Okay, sorry. Moving right along, I have to skip over from somegadgetguy.com. The iPhone SE came in, and this was one of the major contributors to me talking a lot over the last week. I could not be happier to see my buddy and to have a good, long, chill weekend conversation, a conversation spanning 2 days and 4 hours of chat. A lot of it focused on the iPhone SE, but not all of it focused on the iPhone SE for our iPhone coverage. I am, of course, talking about TK Mybay. Joined me on my channel on Friday night. iPhone SE is here, TK Bay and Juan's first impressions. And again, we streamed for about 2 hours and 20 minutes. TK is just such a good dude to have this kind of a conversation with. We did this with the V60. I was bummed that I got my OnePluses late because I would have loved to have done this with the OnePlus 8. And then immediately following that, I mean, we both got about 4 hours of sleep that night and then woke up and did it again on his channel. Our 24-hour impressions was really more like an 18 hours impressions. TK taking a little license with how long we'd actually had the phones. But we also sat down and both of us had done a ton of performance testing. TK did like some of his underwater durability testing. I did some of my video rendering testing, and we did another hour and 40 minutes the day after. So if you needed 4 hours of early commentary on the iPhone SE, I mean, the thing that I love about going back to some of those videos where I don't really love hearing myself talk and ramble on and, you know, my sort of light stutter as I'm trying to collect my thoughts mid-question. The thing that's really cool, and it's something that we both very much appreciate and why I think I get along so well with TK, is the quality of questions and commentary that we get during these live streams is exactly what keeps us invested in conversing about these types of gadgets. There's a lot of, I mean, obviously, again, I mean, I was just hyping up Viper. Obviously, with someone like TK, there is a ton of overlap between our two communities. And for good reason, we appreciate that style of conversation. And that's why we've gotten into tech reviewing, and why I think we get along so well is, It's a lot less about, let me tell you my opinion and here's how you should spend your money. It's more like, I didn't even think of that. Some dude in my live chat just told me about this one crazy feature. Let me go make a video on that because this is awesome. And we get really excited about that back and forth. So it's almost seamless from my chat at night where we're both kind of spaced and kind of out of it to us shaky and under caffeinated in the morning. It's a great duo of videos with a lot of good audience interaction. From Heike in the live chat now, I've begun to be somewhat cautious about YouTube. The core mission seems to be getting you to spend as much time on watching video as possible. That time could be spent in some other more developing activities. It's hugely addictive to watch YouTube hour after hour after hour. Completely agree. I feel anytime algorithms manipulate the feed as opposed to it being chronological, then we're not getting an accurate snapshot of what's really being produced and what content is really available. I think that's why we just all need to be more discerning consumers, because that's not going away. Facebook showed us that it's way more profitable to shake up your timeline than to give you reality. And so that's also why creators like myself and TK are looking at other opportunities and avenues to produce content and to stream content. And it's going to be an ongoing conversation. We can only hope to have educated contributors, not even just audience members, but people who genuinely contribute to these conversations moving forward, so that we know we're having the types of discussions that we want to have, let alone what might make us more popular or earn us more money. I think there, if we're not being true to our passions, then why are we doing this? If it's just to chase metrics, that's really sad. So, all right. And Aditya Anil, TK is an absolute sweetheart, IMO, the most wholesome tech tuber out there. I mean, if there was a wholesomenessometer that we could measure that, if he's not number one, he's top three. Easy. And again, one of the most gracious producers I've ever worked with. Let me get this out of the way here. Okay. So following those two conversations, one of the major, and we're going to be talking about this in the second half of the podcast during the gadget block, I have been very disappointed in the general tech conversation around a phone like the iPhone SE, with headline after headline and influencer tweet after influencer tweet, excuse me, about, you know, oh, Apple, I mean, this $400 phone has a processor that's more powerful than the most expensive Android, exclamation point, italicized font. The A13 is a monster chipset. No one's questioning that. I have a hard time with this topic being brought up time and time and time and time again, and then mostly relying on synthetic benchmarks. So as a prototype of a future series of videos that I want to produce, I've been collecting data on every phone that I review. I keep it in a big lumpy spreadsheet that's terribly organized. It makes sense to me, but it's not very effective for anyone else who would look at that spreadsheet. But anyone who was in my Discord over the weekend got a good earful of the trials and tribulations of one trying to figure out how to make a decent looking bar graph in PowerPoint. There are a lot of things I'm good at. PowerPoint is not one of those things that I'm good at, but I finally figured out sort of a loose format, and it's super basic. I mean, we're not even talking like anything fancy here. It's just literally, how do I make the x-axis relate to the information that I'm trying to show? Because the auto, like, I'm trying to show times, you know, like the time spent video rendering, and the auto formatting is giving me like 7-second increments. So your hash marks don't, it's hard to encapsulate. It's hard to understand what is it that I'm trying to show you when I couldn't lock it to 5-second increments. And it took me way longer than it should have to figure out what the base scale was for making adjustments in PowerPoint. Short story, incredibly long. I got an early version of a series I'm going to be calling By the Benchmarks. So the first official video for this is going to be the OnePlus 8 and OnePlus 8 Pro By the Benchmarks. But the iPhone SE was the first one to kind of get a little bit of this loose treatment where we're going to talk huge performance claims. We're going to talk big numbers and most powerfuls. Well, then we need to actually verify that. If we're not just Apple sycophants, if we're not just parroting and squawking about Apple PR and marketing slides, we need to do something more than just run Geekbench or Antutu and say, see, the numbers are bigger, and that means it's better. There's so much going on in one of these smartphone reviews that maybe it's time for me to start detailing the process that I use to grade all of this. So iPhone SE benchmarked, more powerful than all the Androids, question mark? And it's a short form video just tapping into my early testing, my early impressions on the iPhone SE, and where this phone is an absolute screamer. There is a lot of truth to some of the claims, but then we're not having the reasonable conversation about compromises. And that's something we're going to talk about more in the second half of this podcast. If you have questions, or if there's anything that, you know, you're really, you know, itching to know about the iPhone SE, I'm going to be rambling about that quite a bit at the tail end of this podcast. And then wrapping up my actual videos and my content on Some Gadget Guy, I also still wanted to mix in some audio coverage. I've got a finished and produced hashtag 2020 video. I just haven't had a good window to put it out. So I'm thinking tomorrow, while I wrap up some OnePlus 8 videos, there's going to be another 2020 hearing video out for everybody. It's on the Patreon now, just because I really couldn't find a good time to put it out. I was putting out so much content. But I also got a headphone review out, which is a really interesting twist on a lower cost Bluetooth headphone. This is from the company Shiver, and they're making a 3D spatial head tracking headphone, but it's got an interesting twist to it. The idea isn't 3D audio so that it manipulates your content for positional data. It's 3D audio that it follows your head movements to float like you've got speakers that are following you around. And the hook is, this is supposed to lead to a less fatiguing, longer listening experience. So I've got a pretty in-depth video on a company that isn't tracking very well for SEO. But it was an interesting hook. Like, I haven't heard anyone else making that pitch that positional 3D audio was going to be the killer application for reducing headphone fatigue. So there's a full video out on that you can catch. And from doing the podcast last week and doing those live streams with TK and reviving Creator Chat with Jason Hell, I was honored to join another major outlet for another decent little podcast record. I was kind of tweeting it out. It launched. Did it publish yesterday? Yeah, it published on Sunday. Daniel over at Android Central reached out and just asked if I'd be down to kind of chat about reviewing in general. It's kind of like a mini creator chat where he was asking me a lot of questions about where I came from. So if you go to Android Central, the AC podcast on all of your favorite podcasting platforms, episode 471, Juan Carlos Bagnell is more than just some gadget guy. Daniel is such a chill host. I was very honored to sit down and kind of have a chat with Daniel. Just I like that he takes kind of a philosophical approach to how he's grading his own reviewer performance, and he's working on it in a team. And that's one of the things that was a very interesting conversation for me, from going lone wolf producer to working with Pocket now and then going back to lone wolf producer, but then co-producing on Newegg. Just there are huge philosophical differences in how you go about producing content. Something that goes to some gadget guy, I feel, has to have a very different tone and a very different singular perspective than when I'm trying to write a script for Newegg, where the company name is sort of responsible for a global attitude on the content that they produce, versus how do I honestly share my own personal preferences and biases while grading devices that I might not like, but then I can find value for different consumer demographics. And Daniel was an amazing host to sit down and have that kind of a conversation with. So if your game, like I said, I think I put out 10 hours of podcasting last week. There's a lot that you can listen to if you like the sound of my voice, and I apologize for talking at you that much. But there's also one last little bit of housekeeping. While we're all dealing with the situation, a number of us making humongous life work adjustments. You might be working from home. We're still not entirely sure how companies are going to be looking at the next couple weeks as we debate what stay-at-home orders should resemble. We're still in a situation where I think a number of us are going to be continuing at least part-time work from home as we make transitions back into mainstream flow. This was a really important video for me to hash out with the Newegg producers. I need to talk to them about their titles. Like, I feel like this was not a good SEO title for what it was that we were really talking about. But we put out a video called Working from Home: Tips, Techniques, and Tech. I really feel no one is going to search for that title. But what this is a follow-up video. So I originally put out a video just kind of talking about the psychology of working from home as a producer who mostly works out of a home office. You know, what you can expect from changing, leaving an office and working at home. This video is about refining your setup. So maybe you've got a work laptop. If you've been working from home this whole time, working on your couch from a home laptop is a miserable way to try and get your work done. So let's spruce up, you know, the height of your monitor. Let's try and add a second screen. Let's ergonomically set up your keyboard and mouse. What to do about your webcam, how to improve your audio for audio coming in, and then how you can also, improve your outgoing audio with, like, you know, a piece of gaming gear. Like, in the video, I'm showing off a wireless Audio Technica headset because it's got a phenomenal microphone. You know, who would have guessed that the companies that have traditionally made high-end recording equipment make great gaming headsets? So, this video is actually tracking pretty well for me showing up on camera in a Newegg video. Usually Trisha, her videos do a bit better right out of the gate, but I hope it doesn't fly under the radar too much. You know, from our homeschooling videos to our work at home videos, there is such a great crew of tech knowledge at Newegg with the Newegg Ninjas now, that there's some valuable information in there for anyone who's, you know, maybe you're 90% of the way there, but you're looking for just that one little thing that's going to make your life easier, a quality of life improvement, a tech improvement, a psychology upgrade, just so you can get through this over the next couple weeks. That was a very important video for me to try and produce. So folks, that's housekeeping. Some gadget guy was busy last week. and Sentinel 909 has an hour to chill with us. So everyone say, hey, Sentinel 909. I dig it. And apologies, like my voice is really rough around the edges. Def Burns, 25 minutes. I did it in 25 minutes. He called 30 minutes plus or minus five. I don't know. Do we give Dave Burns the win on that? He gave me a 10-minute margin of error for one of the busiest housekeeping segments I've ever put up. Is that legit? Was that a legit prediction, or should we tag him harder on that? Leave your thoughts in the Oh, Vazikos. I was right. Oh, Aditya Anil, Trisha's video comment section are scary, especially those Kingston videos. Very scary. Trisha's my sister from another mister. We have had numerous conversations about her experiences in the world of tech and the quality of interactions that she gets from different communities. And then the realities of being a host. You know, she's a host who happens to know WTF she is talking about. But you know, whenever we have to produce for another entity or another outlet, we give up a little bit of control over how our likeness is being used and what information we're going to share. And that can be really challenging for anyone, let alone an attractive woman who is good at tech. So yeah, it gets pretty brutal out there. Mr. Pulp Fiction, does Juan's daughter use an iPad? Actually, Juan's daughter, her favorite tech tool right now is a Huawei MatePad that has stylus support. So she likes using a stylus when she's using a sketch app or coloring in one of her kids' games, and considering the costs of technology, a MatePad won't break my soul if she happens to smash it while she's using it. So anyway, let's get into some tech news. Every story, I didn't share all of the links to housekeeping. That would have been ridiculous. All of the links from housekeeping, all of the news that we're going to be sharing, the subreddit plug, all of the show notes will be on somegadgetguy.com after the podcast goes live, so you can keep up with all of the content that we're talking about. And I'm going to try really hard to wrap up the rest of this podcast in under 2 hours, but it's probably going to go a little long because I'm hoping we'll have a good chat. I mean, we've got OnePlus 8 and the iPhone SE and just a variety of news topics to cover, but let's get through news because this week is heavily focused on follow-ups. Just like last week, there are stories that are ongoing in the tech community, and this week is no different. You know, we're not breaking new news, kind of like we were before the situation, but we've got lots to just keep our eye on, and we don't want to let this stuff get too far away from us. So let me get this out of the way here. Number one, it's been a little while since I've covered a net neutrality story. There hasn't been a ton of news or a ton of follow-ups on what's going on with the current state of our regulatory agencies and consumer protections. I think it's pretty clear if you followed my channel in the past, I'm not a big fan of our current FCC. So this story came by way of Tech Dirt. This is just a quick follow-up because we should always examine the claims of major corporations. Often that means I'm kind of poking a stick in the eye of Samsung and Apple, but ISPs have an inordinate amount of power in our current discussion. And right now, we've never leveraged the internet at home like we have today. So Tech Dirt, this is a story written up by Carl Bode. Telecom's latest dumb claim, the internet only works during a pandemic because we killed net neutrality. To hear various net neutrality opponents tell it, the repeal is the primary reason the U.S. internet hasn't fallen apart during the COVID-19 quarantine. We should thank our lucky stars that Title II net neutrality regulations were repealed by the FCC in 2017. In doing so, the U.S. avoided the fate of much of Europe today, where broadband networks are strained and suffering from a lack of investment and innovation. And then Carl goes on to detail a lot of information, which very clearly explains how this is complete hogwash. I would really like to use rated R language on this stream. I don't want to kill my monetization before I even have a chance to monetize this video. But in my heart of hearts, there is nothing that could be less true than a statement like that. And what we've talked about on previous episodes of the podcast, repealing net neutrality has done nothing to spur on broadband innovation. It has done nothing to improve competition, because that's not what net neutrality affects. Net neutrality does not affect broadband deployment. The only reason it affects broadband deployment is because ISPs use it as leverage against investing in their own infrastructure. But we've been paying taxes, we've been paying fees, we've been giving them sweetheart licensing deals, we've let them set up local monopolies, and they still haven't delivered things like fiber to home like they promised they would, even though they've profited to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars off of these investments that we've poured into their coffers. And then they're still complaining that they can't make rural broadband work. No, got to give us more public money. You got to raise rates. We got to tack on more fees. Net neutrality has zero effect on anything that they're talking about. And these conversations about Europe throttling YouTube, it wasn't Europe throttling YouTube. European agencies asked YouTube and Netflix to degrade the quality of their streams, and that was an agreed upon behavior. If you notice, on the Patreon, I upload 4K versions of my videos for patrons. I upload higher quality versions of my reviews. Most people can't stream those 4K streams right now. So even here in the United States, these notes that somehow we've skirted this type of calamity of connection because net neutrality was repealed is still a lie. Most of our content is still being somewhat throttled here in the United States too, as a safety measure. Even though we don't necessarily think we have to, the areas that benefit from it are areas where ISPs have not improved infrastructure. Not a net neutrality issue. So let me get this out of the way here. Sorry. I don't want to hammer on that too long, because the follow-up story to the follow-up story, and also please go read Carl's assessment. There is a lot of good data in this article pointing out the fallacies of these kinds of arguments and how it's easy to throw out a talking point like that. It is much more difficult to correct the misinformation that's being spread. And one of the ways that these companies are able to get away with spreading this kind of misinformation is because our regulatory agency, the FCC, is completely neutered. So while we've been in the middle of a global situation, I know I've already said it once, but let's just hold it to one and hopefully YouTube doesn't ban my video. A global situation, the FCC rejects Citi's extension request for comments on net neutrality rollback. This is another story that hasn't been getting a ton of press, so big props to Rachel England over at Engadget. From the first paragraph of the story, the Federal Communications Commission has come under fire after rejecting a request from city governments to extend the period for which comments may be submitted on its plans to repeal net neutrality. The cities of Los Angeles and New York, along with the Santa Clara County Central Fire Protection District, asked the FCC to extend the April 20th deadline by an additional 60 days because they have been otherwise focused on managing the situation. The FCC refused, noting that it had already granted a 30-day extension back in March and suggesting that the pandemic has been going on long enough that the parties involved should have asked for an extension sooner. So that's great. I don't think a lot of people caught the news that we are back in another cycle of courtroom battles over the repeal of net neutrality. The FCC is still lining up against state governments. Remember, Ajit Pai is super against states' rights. You know, states' rights only benefit when they allow them to break federal government standards. But when states try to create their own regulatory agencies, Ajit Pai is super against that. So we're talking crazy lawsuits against New York and California for daring to propose their own net neutrality legislation. And even if you're anti-net neutrality, you should want some kind of weak federal standard, because then the states don't get involved. Right now, we're looking at 50 different iterations of what the internet could look like, because we have 50 different state governments all looking at what doing business on the internet should look like. That's way worse. Even for someone who is an advocate for net neutrality, we don't want that. We want one general federal standard that's going to be largely toothless except for extreme transgressions. And that makes the most sense as one guiding rule book that everyone can follow. That's going to be way better for businesses than saying like, oh, does this violate California policy? Oh, but New York has different protections for privacy. Oh, but Washington State has, you know, bigger fines for this type of transgression. No one wants to do business on the internet that way. Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together. So, Engadget with a decent write-up, just kind of, again, we should keep our eye on this. We're asking for some consideration for public comments, which we know the FCC is going to ignore anyway, but we want a public record so that we can point to good data when they try to lie. You know, when Ajit Pai was repealing net neutrality from the beginning, he was like, oh, well, we couldn't trust any of the comments. And it was like a coin flip whether people were for net neutrality or against it. None of that data panned out. Oh, well, we've got to repeal net neutrality because it's going to spur on broadband competition. That was a lie. Oh, we're getting more Americans connected and fewer people are slipping through the cracks. The FCC's assessment of how many households can't get broadband right now might be off by a factor of 3. We don't even know how many people don't have access to broadband, let alone the people who do have access but totally can't afford it. We don't know how many people are missing from the internet right now because of the FCC. It's real bad and it's real gross. So, and Matt Tyler, talking about some issues that they're having out in the UK right now. And that does not sound great. So anyway, I've already done a terrible job of trying to share links, but we're moving on. I will have those links, like I said, on the show notes on somegadgetguy.com. But we still, with everything else that's going on right now, this is a story that we need to just be somewhat aware of how these agencies are operating and how they're doing business and what they're doing in our name, because they come from, you know, the elections process. You know, Ajit Pai would not be the chairman of the FCC if voters hadn't spoken during the Trump campaign. So if we're not aware of this, they get to do a lot that we might not like. And so, you know, whether you're liberal or conservative, it's a story that I feel just needs to be vaguely somewhere on your radar. The other major topic that we've been trying to untangle, one of the reasons why I love doing this weekly show and the community of people who are in my comments right now, I feel like some of these are very deeply philosophical issues in our society. They are such huge philosophical problems that they're, first, they're just really hard to wrap my brain around. And it's like I need people to bounce ideas off of, but the notion of trying to come up with a satisfying conclusion to some of these problems just seems way bigger than what I feel I can contribute to a discussion like this. So over the last couple of weeks, we've been covering stories about conspiracy theories, about vandalism, people attacking 5G towers, the spreading of bad information like a virus, you know, and terrible meme style virus in social media. And it seems last week the dam broke on social media companies trying to do something about this. And at the same time, I think we should all appreciate some action in this regard. I know a bunch of you have to feel like me. Additional manipulation of the content that we consume from social media should make us a little edgy. You know, who watches The Watchmen, right? On its surface, to start this off, I am appreciative of the steps that these companies have taken to try and manage the deluge of terrible information that's spreading online right now. The way that these companies operate and that they are private entities that are being tasked with very public communication makes me a little nervous. So this is an emotionally conflicted Juan, largely expressing some appreciation, but in the back of his brain, danger Will Robinson, arms flailing, concern. There's some concern. Sorry, I'm trying not to clip my mic. Let's round robin these stories as efficiently as we can. Twitter, on the official Twitter blog, posted a very in-depth breakdown on their global communications responsibilities as it pertains to the situation. You can find that coronavirus, staying safe and informed on Twitter. This is a lot of corporate guidance. So if you're watching this on the live stream, we've got bullet point one, helping people find reliable information. Bullet point two, protecting the public conversation. Each of these have sub-bullet points, by the way. Partnering with organizations and public engagement for number three. Number four, ensuring site reliability. Number five, keeping our employees and partners safe. Number six, sharing Twitter's metrics. And each of those has between 3 and 8 sub-bullet points as a corporate examination of Twitter's own policy regarding manipulated data, misinformation, and trying to aid in a discussion about public safety. Of all the companies that... did I say it again? Yeah. So I've said it twice now. Of all the companies that have had something of a checkered history with their own internal policy, let alone any type of, you know, public dispute process, Twitter ranks pretty high on a list that I feel is very inconsistent in how they manage and affect the user base on their own platform. Because of this humongous corporate document that they put out, it's also going to be very challenging to grade Twitter's behavior in the future. Did they live up to these six major bullet points with all of these sub categories, sub articles? Could they even live up to their own estimation of their attempts at managing, you know, this misinformation crisis? So we can at least see Twitter's response. Moving quickly through the companies that also are trying to make some news about this, Engadget posted a great write-up on WhatsApp in a slightly less corporate bravado kind of way. WhatsApp has been limiting how users can forward information. So let's see. WhatsApp says its forwarding limits are slowing the spread of fake news. Another great story written up by Rachel England. Message forwarding has dropped by 70% in recent weeks. So instead of creating the same type of popularity echo chamber, WhatsApp has been trying to mitigate or trying to manage how far a piece of information can spread individually. And again, I like to point to this as some kind of viral infection. It's a viral infection of bad ideas in the brain. If you can create some sort of control barriers or boundaries, then you can also kind of help minimize. It's interesting because like social media has built up this like popularity drug. You know, you want to see something go viral. You want to see it spread. Your self-worth isn't defined by the quality of the content, but how far it can reach. And I think the next phase of communications on the internet, the next generation of people consuming content that are just coming up as kids now, will probably be far less impressed with huge, big numbers on YouTube. And that they're going to be much more engaged in a tighter knit community of like-minded individuals. I'm already seeing kind of those trends, right? Everyone has a Facebook account, but kids aren't using Facebook. You know, everyone's on Instagram, but when kids are on Instagram, it's often on a dummy account that their parents don't know about. You know, it's about reining in the spread. They're still, you know, looking for validation just like older content creators like myself, but they're going about it in a very different way than just the first generation of viral content hitting social media. Boing Byte, everyone's on Discord. You know, again, if you can't point to a better example of lock down my community, keep it as a circle of friends, make it much more organic with more real interactions. I can't point to a better example than Discord. And so WhatsApp seems to be trying to create a public facing reduced circle of influence. Again, a different approach. It doesn't seem to be trying to censor content or trying to remove content from the WhatsApp platform, but it's a considered approach that I think will probably benefit WhatsApp users. Again, it's interesting to see the different philosophies as these different tactics are employed, because the one I'm most worried about, and even though I've now said the situation's name, Voldemort style, is of course YouTube, where my YouTube metrics, my YouTube watch time is up 38%. My YouTube subscriber base is up another 3,000 subs over the last 28 days. And my actual views are also up like 30%. My demographics are all looking way better month over month. Just like everyone else, people are watching more content. More people are finding my YouTube channel. And my revenue's down another 5% from where we were last month. So anything that we can do to kind of stave that off, YouTube is going to be getting a lot more brutal about banning content on their platform. This is coming by way of Business Insider. YouTube CEO suggested content that goes against WHO guidance on the situation. Ah, dang it, that's three. This video is totally getting demonetized. Against the situation will be banned. Susan, I can't pronounce her last name, Wojcicki? Anyway, YouTube CEO Susan has suggested that the video platform will remove content that contradicts the World Health Organization's advice on the situation. In an interview with CNN published on Sunday, the CEO said YouTube would be removing information that is problematic, including anything that is medically unsubstantiated. So we've been having a number of conversations about things like torching 5G towers. And doing actual, public malicious acts, using the ignorance of people to incite them and to encourage them into acts of destabilizing mischief. This to me would be an amazing opportunity to destabilize a region. If I were a bad actor in a state that was not simpatico with the UK or the USA or the EU, I would be trying to fuel as many individuals as I could to this type of, destabilizing the telecommunications grid of that region. on top of that, we also have some very worrying conversations happening from people who should know better about how to treat disease. And I have struggled, and in our comments, you know, in the videos, in the podcasts that we've been working on over the last couple of weeks, it's a really heady problem. It's a really heady discussion to have. How do we go about trying to salvage people who have been infected with this kind of doctrine, and knowing that this type of misinformation is being, you know, radicalized on platforms that help spread bad ideas like YouTube and Facebook. So again, I'm appreciative of YouTube joining this conversation to say, hey, we're going to try and work this back. We're going to try and remove content that is problematic. I just don't have a ton of faith in a platform that is heavily automated, algorithmically heavily automated, and has zero accountability. There is no dispute process at YouTube. You screw up, you're gone. Your Gmail account, your Google account could be completely removed from you. And there's almost no recourse if something like that happens, except making so much noise publicly with huge YouTube creators that YouTube maybe walks it back or gives you a warning. But the main process is so robotically automated. It's scary to take any kind of risk in discussing these situations right now. I know I've already stumbled a bunch of times, but why I'm being so winky about the situation is because the rules for me with 100,000 subscribers are completely different than the rules for people with a couple million subscribers. They can talk about the situation all they want. They are not graded or ranked on content in the same way that I am. If you need any examples of that, like, look at how many public transgressions someone like a Logan Paul can get and still kind of front a very profitable enterprise utilizing YouTube servers. If I were to make a tenth as many missteps, I mean, I couldn't even make that many missteps. If I made one major misstep in the same fashion that blew up in the way that his have, I'd be completely stricken from the platform and like, you know, 1984 style, erased from history. So I don't know how to fix the spread of this terrible, terrible misinformation, which infects the minds and the hearts and the souls of the most vulnerable members of our society. You know, we might write off flat earthers, but now we're seeing 5G conspiracies and situation conspiracies leading to actual public harm, public infrastructure harm, and people doing dangerously stupid things. I really want to hope and I really want to believe that YouTube is going to take a measured and nuanced approach into how they remove content from their platform, but I don't trust them. I just don't. I really don't know. I mean, like, it kind of feels like the entire social media and influencer industry needs to crater. It needs to, like, fundamentally break, so that we can rebuild something that's built more on authenticity than it is on outrage, traffic, and clickbait. And that's a scary proposition too, because we don't know that it would be rebuilt in a better way. I've got a ton of comments in here. Dave Burns, profit and ethics are mutually exclusive on YouTube, apparently. From Sam F. Logan Paul, that dude is a punk. I don't think anyone would disagree with Sam there. LFA reviews, so true. Different sets of rules apply based on social reach and sub count, unwritten, but definitely in practice. And like, trackable. We can see when people are demonetized or when they're sort of shadow banned on YouTube or when they're outright, you know, striked, community striked. It's also why I'm so aggressive in my comments, is because I'm responsible for the comments on my videos, guys. That's why I've taken to this, like, you know, muting approach, this insta ban hammer. I'm not giving people second chances and third chances, because it literally can shut my channel down if I'm getting a preponderance of really gross comments in my on my videos. from Natakun. I have a coworker that believes in flat Earth. We didn't go to the moon. The virus is fake, and this is all a plot to get us all injected with microchips. And he gets all of his information from YouTube. See, and you're like, I don't know how to reach that person. That person to me seems like a lost cause, but how do we stop that person from infecting other people? And it's a freaky, scary conversation. I don't know what we do. From Fat Produce, everyone say hey to Fat Produce. Andrew Wallace, I didn't trust YouTube enough to have the brosips on YouTube over Twitch. And a few of us, I mean, it's one of the main reasons why I now stream my podcast on Twitch and every other streaming site, as opposed to streaming on YouTube. I mean, like, these would get demonetized in real time during the stream before I would ever have a chance to correct for that. And if your videos continuously get demonetized, YouTube just punishes your channel. It doesn't matter that you dispute the demonetization and get your video remonetized. You're still already suspect on YouTube's algorithm. From Fat Produce, how would you gauge your success on the Twitch platform compared to YouTube so far? I gauge success by quality of interaction. I get great conversations on YouTube when I'm streaming gadget-focused stuff. I don't think I could point to better examples of that than TK and I streaming iPhone SE. So if it's a focused topic and it's not broad and it's not news is controversial, then YouTube is fine. And I still have to do a lot more weeding and moderating, but it's genuinely solid interactions. For covering the types of topics that we talk about on this podcast, where I still hold to a news block that can be a little controversial and heavily political, this would be a no-go on YouTube. Twitch seems interested not in the slightest in stepping on any of my content here. I can record the show and upload it to YouTube separately, where it'll probably get demonetized, but I can hold it for just long enough that I can start the remonetization process. It still probably hurts my YouTube channel. I have not gotten any information. I had 100,000 subscribers in November. In November? Yeah, I think I hit 100K in November of last year. There's still been no communication about a play button. When you hit 100,000 subscribers, you're supposed to get your first cute little play button. No one's reached out to me for that. And you're also supposed to get some of the other monetization tools for, like, channel subscriptions. So you can set up your own, like, YouTube-based Patreon. You know, you can paywall some content. It's supposed to be super handy. 100,000 subscribers, and you get to unlock all these other great tools. I don't get that. So, I mean, like, if I'm going to spend this much effort to get to earn less money every month on YouTube, even with huge spikes, 30 to 40% spikes in my viewership, increasingly, I'm going to be looking at a diversifying. And again, I'll clue people in. I put the lowest quality version of my videos on YouTube now. So Patreon, that's where you get the full quality 4K. I mean, if you care about that, that's the paywall benefit. You get a different video. It's a higher quality video. But if you go to somegadgetguy.com, you'll at least get the faster frame rates. So I do a 60 frame per second video for a 1080p video for Twitch. And then I upload that video to Twitch and I embed that video on somegadgetguy.com. Increasingly, I think I'm just going to kick it down to 24 frames per second, 1080p on YouTube, because I'm so frustrated with how YouTube does business. So that's the hierarchy. Best quality, head on over to Patreon. Very good quality, head over to somegadgetguy.com. You just want to slum it, you could go to YouTube. That's my experiment for diversifying and building audiences in other places. From Sam, I'm never getting monetized. I'm very liberal with the colorful metaphors on our stream. Sam and Matt have been putting out some phenomenal live streams on Sundays, which you guys should check out too. I love the split between Matt's chill British vibe and Sam's lit up and amped American vibe. It's like... Not that they look like these animals, but it's like a lit up angry chihuahua having a brunch conversation with a really, really chill mastiff. You know, like I can't say enough nice things about their stream. Up and coming. It's on Twitch. It's definitely rated R and grown up material, adult situations, but it's a fun stream. So I have a, here, let me get this out of the way here. So two more stories before we hit the Reddit plug. The first one, every company is facing very unique challenges as corporations have different reach and different distribution. I think it's very important that we keep some corrective actions in comparison. So I'm sure if you're following my podcast, I'm sure a number of you saw the headlines, man, OnePlus is laying off people in Europe. It looks like they're not popular in Europe. It looks like the OnePlus mission is failing. The OnePlus 8 is too expensive, and now they're having to lay people off. And that's not really true. So if we go straight to the horse's mouth, let me screen share here again. This is from the OnePlus forums. Who wrote this up? Thomas? I don't know how to pronounce that name. Tuomas. Updates on strategic changes in Europe. As OnePlus enters its next phase of strategic growth, we have been evaluating our opportunities for long-term development and sustainability. We have decided to make some changes to the current organizational structure within Europe to better streamline our operations while continuing to meet the needs of our growing community. These changes only apply to Europe, which remains a key region for OnePlus, where we are committed to bringing the best products and services to users as we have done since day one. Skipping to the end, we are doing everything we can to support the approximately 20 total employees in these three markets who will be affected by this restructuring, including offering redundancy packages per local regulations. We highly value the contributions of these staff members and will do our best to ensure a smooth transition throughout this process. So they're talking about how they've experienced growth in some regions of Europe, how they've kind of flatlined in other regions of Europe, and that they're just making changes to markets like Germany, France, and the UK. To hear the headlines on this story is that, you know, OnePlus is facing significant challenges and difficulties and that they're layoffs. And when you just leave it at layoffs, it sounds like they're slashing workforces. OnePlus doesn't run a tremendously huge operation considering the global influence that they have. It's a big company, but it's not like a Samsung, right? You know, it's not like an LG even, for all of LG's regional distribution issues. If the headline were OnePlus restructures and 20 employees will be redundant, well, that wouldn't generate as much traffic as OnePlus announces layoffs, slashing jobs in Europe. I feel like the clickbait isn't properly addressing the reality of what this situation actually entails. And from Heikki, they're moving their headquarters to Helsinki, not downsizing. you kind of go where there's a market and a growth and an appreciation for the products and services that you offer. Goran Petrovic, you do not buy enough OnePlus, they close the shop there. I mean, like, that's the truth of every major corporation. You don't keep sending phones to a region that's not buying your phones. Or you stop sending phones to regions that are sort of hostile to outside competition or have market forces that you don't want to contend with. And again, like everyone here is like from burn notice, makes me dizzy just hearing clickbait misleading titles, because you can't help but scroll over that headline and get just like it's in your brain. You know, like you get that little light, you know, it's like that little tweak, you get that little nudge and you're like, what's going on? I got to know. But then when you really read the article, it's like that had nothing to do with what they were trying to manipulate me into feeling. Dave Burns, Juan is a OnePlus shill. I mean, put them all in there. I'm a, what is it? BlackBerry, Sony, LG, Pixel, OnePlus shill. Because those are the phones that I've been focusing on a bit more for my longer term coverage. Gary the Fireman, clickbait over the top. Dave Burns, the clickbait is strong. And negativity buys clicks. Matt Tyler, I thought he was an LG shell. Gary the Fireman, and now Apple. Dave Burns, that hashtag is too many characters. I'll reach my limit. Mr. Pulp Fiction, OnePlus isn't a big player in the US, right? OnePlus, it's hard to get great data. Excuse me, I'm drinking a lot of water, so I apologize to the audio listeners that I'm going to be burping a lot on the stream. OnePlus is a bit tricky because when they put out the positive headlines on their growth, it's usually within a certain price envelope. If I remember correctly, they were the number one growing brand in phones over $600 around the launch of the OnePlus 7T. I don't believe they have cracked the top five in overall gadgets sold in the United States. But if you limit the price tier to the upper end of the market, then I believe they are now a top five company in the United States. That is very difficult to parse. And smartphone sales are always a little bit suspect. Sometimes we're looking at numbers of shipped units, so it might be stock sitting on shelves. And sometimes we're looking at activations, where that data can also be somewhat manipulated by how carriers get involved in the conversation and how Google and Apple might report, you know, activations of Android versus activations of iOS. It's really hard just to get sales receipts. Literally, this is the number of consumers who bought our products. No company, I believe, really likes to detail that as a cold, hard fact of a number. So OnePlus has actually been doing really well. The United States is so starved for competition that a OnePlus phone at T-Mobile resonated, especially with the OnePlus 6T. We saw huge, significant gains in North America. That was a great strategic partnership. The OnePlus 6T, I think, was the most important phone of its generation. Not necessarily the best phone, but like represented one of the first times we'd seen a Chinese-backed company actually live up to their marketing, their claims, dig into a carrier partnership where Huawei and ZTE have struggled, and maximize that relationship for significant sales gains. And they were. I mean, that T-Mobile partnership on its own, I think, doubled the total number of OnePlus phones sold in North America all by itself. So, sorry, I got to stretch. From Heike, one thing is that in all major media outlets, there are different writers for titles than to the articles. Yeah, this is also true, too. It is usually a completely different person who writes the title, and that person may not have proper time to read through the article carefully. This is part of the clickbait problem nowadays. And even in smaller, you know, like I'd write up a really great article and I'd ship it over, and then editors at Pocket Now would maybe put a different twist or a different spin on the title than what I had put on the article. It goes on one part, maybe the person writing the title doesn't have as much information. It could also just be we're looking at SEO and analytics, and like if I put this keyword here, it's going to do better for the article than what you wrote. It's all real messy. From Sneed Mobile Tech on Periscope, now T-Mobile is the second largest market share. The OnePlus deal with T-Mobile looks good. It's going to be interesting to see how OnePlus weathers this storm. It's going to be interesting to see how every phone company weathers this storm, but OnePlus is especially critical. They're such a sweetheart Android tech fan base. That right now the fan base is somewhat turning on them in a very disappointing way. Like, I'd want tech enthusiasts to be more sort of more aware of markets and how this stuff works. But, you know, expensive phones are going to struggle this year. And the iPhone SE is giving us some very clear indications on where competition can go for 2021, or at least even just for the second half of 2020. One last story before we get to the Reddit plug. for all of my criticisms of massive corporations and humongous organizations, you know, Apple is a $1 trillion company. I really need to celebrate when the company gets things right. I will continue to highlight my problems with their marketing and PR, overpromising and underdelivering, and especially how I feel they've completely disrupted the conversation about topics like right to repair legislation. But this was a special little anniversary for fans of the Apple brand, because this is one of the things that I think Apple has absolutely demonstrated, that their approach to refinement is superior to most of their competition. I am roundabout getting to the 5th anniversary of the Apple Watch. So Matt Swider, I don't know why I pulled this link. This was the first one that I saw, so I emailed it to myself, but I should have just gone straight to TechRadar. And they don't have it linked here. But this is from MSN. The Apple Watch turns 5. What we got right and what we got wrong. Matt Swider over at TechRadar is a real cool dude. I like Matt. Let me get this in here. And it's just a really charming look back at the launch of the original Apple Watch, which was kind of a garbage product and built more on hype, especially with the $10,000 Apple Watch edition that they put out. But Apple stuck to a refinement policy as opposed to a replacement policy. And by the time we get to the Apple Watch today, Apple is completely deserving of all of the credit and all of the kudos they get for making a baller, just an absolutely fantastic wearable option. This was another thing I was in Viper's live stream kind of commenting on, and just like, a little disappointed in some of the conversation from Apple aficionados. Like, if you could somehow open up the Apple Watch, it would be a runaway steamroller success for the Android community too. If I could pair my Apple Watch, I have a Series 4. If I could pair my Apple Watch with any of my Androids, it would make me very happy to rock that dual ecosystem solution, even if it were a little compromised, like maybe I didn't have the same sort of integrated app support. Even then, I would still probably prefer this wrist experience to Android Wear. In Android Wear, I very much like my TicWatch. I've got a TicWatch Pro LTE from last year. Great watch. It's very good. I think Android Wear has done Google has done a very poor job of keeping Android Wear up to date with sort of the changing philosophy of wrist-worn computing. And if I'm picking anything to go outside with, now I'm really focused on my Focals. The best low-contact, heads-up display information and notification delivery service is not on your wrist. It's putting that information up at eye level, and in a way where you don't have to touch your face or touch your hands or touch your wrist. It can be all self-contained. And even there, the Apple Watch takes a back seat to the Focals. But the Focals are a very niche and boutique kind of product. So the absolute runaway winner for a notification delivery service, for great health tracking features. Even something as simple as the hearing protection guide. There's a little applet on the Apple Watch. You turn it on and you get a reasonably accurate measurement of sound levels around you. That is huge. Can anyone in this audience tell me what 85 dB sounds like? How loud is 85 decibels? Quantify that idea for me. General consumers are going to have no idea what you're talking about if you say, you got to stay under 85 decibels if you want to keep your ears safe. But you fire up an Apple Watch, you tap a little applet, and boom, you've got levels showing you what the sound, the noise in your environment actually resembles. That's insane. That is such a helpful little tool for, you know, safety, for health and safety on a technological platform. So happy birthday to the Apple Watch. I really wish that the success of the Apple Watch were spurring on more direct competition from other wearable technology platforms. The Apple Watch is probably my high watermark before I hope we can all move on to face computing, because that's the next organic evolution, right? You know, this action of looking down at my wrist is an extremely rude and still disruptive act in social situations. And if I want notifications just to kind of pop out, you know, at eye level, and I can ignore them and just keep talking to the person I'm talking to, that's the next step. Smartwatches were always one evolutionary step. They were never going to be the end of the journey. So what we've learned from Apple Watch, I hope this is what directly informs Apple's forays into augmented reality and face computing, because that, to me, is the next exciting challenge. I have a couple questions here from Sam34 and from Muppinish. How do I feel about Huawei watches? From my last experience with a Huawei was the Huawei Watch GT. And I think Huawei makes absolutely beautiful hardware, and they are phenomenal fitness trackers. But I don't really feel like they truly push over into being good smartwatches. Their own proprietary OS is gorgeously streamlined, very quick, very fluid, easy to navigate. They take me back to like the original idea behind Android Wear. You know, that cards notification, it's very streamlined, but it's faster and more efficient and actually more useful in situations than trying to navigate all around turning dials or swiping in different directions. Like, all of that's clutter. That does not help you at a glance do something faster on your wrist than you can do it on your phone. But the Huawei GT is, I think, one of the most beautiful fitness trackers I've ever reviewed. It just doesn't have the same follow through on some of the smarter services, on some of the smarter features to make it a full wearable computer. Like, to me, it's no question I would so much rather wear a Huawei watch than a Fitbit. Easy win. Easy win for the Huawei watch. Not something I would replace my Apple Watch with, right? Like, if I had the choice between, I'm going to be leaving the house with the SIM card in my iPhone SE if I ever leave this house. Obviously, I'm leaving with the Apple Watch and not with my GT. And Sneed Mobile Tech, I would like a Moto 360 refresh with 2 years of support and high quality connectivity and app support. And this is another major problem. Qualcomm kind of dictates what type of kernel support you get long term. Because it's a Qualcomm chipset in every other competitor's watch. And it's a huge missed opportunity. Like, we talked about last week how Google might be getting into their own chip fabrication and chip design, and they're going to be working with Samsung to try and stray from the Qualcomm monopoly. This also affects things like wearables. Our wearables can only be so good as supporting Qualcomm-licensed technologies. And if Qualcomm doesn't see any particular benefit in giving us better options for wrist computers, we're proper screwed. There's nothing we can do about it until more companies start diversifying their chip design and chip fabrication portfolios. So Apple will always have an entrenched advantage in long-term support. Look at the OnePlus X. You can't get future versions of Android onto that phone because licensing agreements and kernel support ended on Qualcomm's say-so. And again, OnePlus will get the bulk of the criticisms. Motorola will get the bulk of the criticisms on their smartwatches and on their phones. I feel Qualcomm deserves a little bit more of the spotlight for a lot of the issues we have in the mobile communication space. Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
The Android Police Podcast comes at you 3 times a week to talk about the latest in Android news and to chat with our colleagues in tech media about wider subjects like the auto industry and what we do at trade shows. And we also do a fun Q&A stream each week, too. Catch us live on twitch.tv/AndroidPolice or listen anywhere you get your podcasts.
See, in Root Knight 5, speaking of Qualcomm, considering how old smartwatch chipsets are, I guess they just aren't seeing a market in that. Yeah, they're not refining. Even this new, like, what is it, the 3100 chip that's currently, and that's already a chip that's 2 years old. It's basically just a 2100 with an extra low power setting. It's not more powerful, it's not faster, and it's barely more battery efficient. So you look at the Fossil watches, and they're touting like, man, you can go like 2 days on a charge. But you can do that on a Tick watch way easier because of the second screen technology. Mobvoi, I don't know what the name, how to pronounce the name of the company. With the Tick watch, they opted for the cheaper chipset, which is just as powerful, but they put in more RAM and they added a low power screen. And you get better battery life for that. I'm sorry, every single Fossil watch is gonna lose against the Tick watch if you're talking about a low power performer. Including their low power setting, which will track your steps and just act like a regular watch and pedometer for up to a month on a single charge. You turn off all the smart features, you'll get weeks of battery life, whereas on a Fossil, you'll get a week in their low power mode. But I digress. Let me take another drink of water because we got to plug the subreddit here real quick. So every podcast has a subreddit. My podcast is no different. I need to adjust my lumbar support pillow. This is not me like farting in my chair. Yes, I said that out loud. Juan's going a little stir crazy. Every podcast has a subreddit. Some subreddits are focused on sharing news clips. Some subreddits are focused on hanging out with the community. My podcast has a subreddit. But like I mentioned at the top of this podcast, I am increasingly becoming more invested in trying to spread the word on content creators who deserve more attention. Obviously, that can be larger channels and subreddit. I mean, larger channels and creators and outlets. And, you know, I don't really feel like Mr. Mobile needs my help, but he's covered a couple videos recently, which I feel for a channel his size have underperformed. And again, I'd like to point to the algorithm. Mr. Mobile does not get to experiment on his channel very often because even a channel like his can be negatively affected by too many videos that underperform by YouTube's metrics. Again, if YouTube senses that there's a downturn in your viewership, your channel gets wrecked for search recommendations and for search results. So I would like to highlight creators who deserve more attention. Could be a smaller player that's trying to reach their monetization. It could be a larger channel that just deserves more eyeballs on their content. And I especially love to highlight creators, you know, like a Flossie Carter. If you're talking about a big channel, for his subscriber base, his videos should be performing better. And it's nothing on him. He's been putting out some of the most consistent content we've ever seen from any creator out there. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Every week we pick up a few more members, a few more subscribers. Every week I'm seeing more sharing, more conversation. We desperately need your participation, your upvotes, your comments. As much as we can make individual topics more popular, this could be a great feeder subreddit so that these videos and these articles are being shared on larger subreddits. And we're starting to see a little bit of that migration. Someone who shares a topic on glowing rectangles and then it shows up on our Apple or our iPhone or our Android, some of these really, really big platforms, that can make such a huge difference for folks in this community. So it's not often, this is not common. I am usually not at the top of my own subreddit, but remember I had a really busy week last week. So it just filled me with such joy, that my face is at the top of our glowing rectangles this week, but my Newegg video is the video that took the number one spot on our glowing rectangles, working from home tips, techniques, and tech from Newegg Studios. You still get your some punchable face, but it's not a Some Gadget Guy video that made it to the top. From Dave Burns, we keep downvoting you, but you keep showing up, dang it. I love the hate for me and my own subreddit. No, I'm serious. Like, it fills me with such joy. I woke up this morning and could not have been happier that that was the video that made it to the top of the subreddit. Like I said, it was never destined to be one of the harder hitting videos on Newegg, but it was such a labor of love to work with the Newegg ninjas on trying to help. We are such savvy tech consumers and we get access to all this cool gear. And sometimes I feel we get lost in our own celebration of this cool tech. And we forget that part of our mission is to make life a little easier for people who don't have access to all the cool toys that we get to play with. So, NLFA, my LG V40 post got upvoted nicely. That was the top. What did they call that? So on Reddit, you submit links and posts and something else. I can't remember. But the top just general post was LFA talking about picking up an LG V40. This is about time someone who reviews headphones had an LG in their locker of review tech. Moving into the number two spot, Ryan Thomas talking about the iMessage problem. 42,000 subscribers and looking at sort of the future of communication apps, where iMessage still holds a significant advantage for iPhone users over the myriad number of failed Google experiments for messaging. This is a very interesting conversation on just sort of that broader landscape of how do you communicate with people. Then into the number three spot, we've got an LG V60 ThinQ unboxing and first look from Tech Examined. And I could have sworn I was subscribed to his channel. We're going to fix that right now. Moving through the rest of the top five, we've got the Shiver 3D Bluetooth headphone review. We've got the iPhone SE 2. For the Love of Tech was disappointed in the iPhone SE. LG V60 5G dual screen review, the things I liked and the things I didn't from TK Bay. Even though I only shared it yesterday, tracking pretty well was my podcast interview with the Android Central podcast. And then rounding out the top 10, we've got a pair of videos here that are really cool content. Dean Nimmin produces some great how-to tips and tricks videos for content creators. If you're trying to step up your game, you should absolutely be checking out his videos. And he's got just this little tutorial on how to make a better thumbnail in Snapseed. So let's say you shoot an awesome video on your phone and you're like me and you edit and you finish off that video. You don't want to have to go to your main PC just to make a thumbnail. Right? That seems counterproductive. I shot this video, I edited this video, I uploaded this video all from my phone. I should be able to make a thumbnail. Snapseed, free app. And he's got a great little tips and tricks video here on one simple effect. It's, you know, the image is someone out in nature holding their arms up, and the word adventure is under the person, in between the person and the background of the photo. So it's kind of a layered effect for making a thumbnail. And, you know, it's a little low tech how he achieves this, effect. But if you didn't know how to do it, this is a supremely helpful video. And then sort of tied at the end of our top 10 roundup, the iPad Pro cannot replace my MacBook Pro. 6 huge reasons why from Terry Warfield. And again, if you want to broaden the conversation and you want to fill in some of the gaps from marketing, it's very easy to casually throw out there, a phone can replace this, a tablet can replace that. I am guilty of a lot of that conversation because I genuinely believe that these products are powerful enough, but you also still need to examine the flip side. What are some of the compromises you might make? And Terry's got some solid reasons why for him, an iPad Pro won't get his job done. And that might resonate with folks out there who are considering maybe making the switch. So that's the subreddit. Let me take another drink of water here. My voice is getting a little fuzzy here, so I might need to quiet down just a bit. Uh, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. I make this plea every week. If you check out the subreddit, and I mean, you haven't been before, I guarantee you, you're going to find content creators that you've never seen in your YouTube feed, in your suggested video topics, and that you're going to find someone that is going to become one of your all-time favorites. Content creators need your support. If you're fortunate enough to be able to support monetarily, that's amazing. And that's incredible. And I can tell you firsthand, so many of my videos would not be created if it weren't for some of those direct contributions. They are literally subsidizing the content that I produce. But above and beyond, joining live streams, sharing on social media, sharing on platforms like Reddit, subscribing, thumbs ups, comments, the interactions mean more than you might understand. Participation, active participation beyond just a casual view, is greatly appreciated. And I've got people here in this live chat that can attest to that. I've got people who are established. I've got people who are up and coming. They will tell you a main factor in whether or not they make another product, they make another video, is largely informed by the experiences they've had and the interactions they've had on their previous videos. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. My subreddit is one resource. It's one thing to try and help. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here. If you're watching a podcast like mine, you're already ahead of the curve. But continuing to help, to share, to spread that message, we need to be the change we want to see in the world. So I can't thank you enough for your participation. And I assure you, all of the other content creators who regularly get featured on subreddits like mine absolutely appreciate any support that you can offer in light of the current situation we all find ourselves in. And LFA reviews, it's truly highly appreciated. So, I want to get into Gadget Block. Gadget Block is going to be dominated by iPhone SE and OnePlus 8, but I do have a couple quick stories to share. I shot a video on this last week for Newegg. I think it's going to be out this week. This is a major, a supremely interesting development in the world of home content creation and streaming. And again, like in that video I did for Newegg, you might be sitting down to stream a lot of content or to engage on video conferencing tools. I cannot tell you how impressed I've been by NVIDIA's RTX Voice. So I'm just going to link to their setup page for the show notes on this video. But I did a crazy test on my Discord server, just a couple quick samples back and forth, where I was able to record both with RTX on and off at the same time, because I've got a ridiculous recording setup for a solo producer like myself. It is shockingly good. If you've noticed, there have been a couple moments where I've gotten a little stumbly during this podcast, right? I mean, I'm managing a lot. I'm looking and I'm reading through your live chat. I'm managing how I do screen share. I've got my recording window, so I'm kind of conscious if I'm peeking, if I'm getting too close to the microphone, and I'm trying to organize all of my articles to share. And as many of you have witnessed, ever since we moved into Gadget Lab 3 and the time change, we've got landscapers who love to come and run leaf blowers like right outside my window for very long periods of time. So you might have noticed during this broadcast, there have been a couple moments where I've gotten a bit foggy, or I've kind of stumbled over some words. I've had a roundabout way of getting back to the point I was trying to make. Now, one of the key things that you can point to whenever that happens to me is I'm very easily distracted by those leaf blowers. It's a noise that I cannot think through, and it completely derails my train of thought. I would like to ask if anyone in the live chat has heard the leaf blowers during this broadcast. And I'm going to pause for just a second here. Has anyone? Have you heard that droning hum of leaf blowers during this live stream? Sam says no. LFA says no. Chatty Boy says nah. Gary the Fireman says no. Dave Bo 9, come for the tech rant, stay for the leaf blower rants. Muppinish says nope. Mr. M-Dub, no. Jim, no. They have been hovering outside my window for about 20 minutes of this broadcast. Dave Bazikos, it's magic. Matt Tyler laughing. Burn Notice, Nada, and I'm on a sound system. So I have been running RTX Voice during this live stream. I'm streaming out of OBS, and I've got RTX plugged in as my mic feed, and it's pulling my mic in real time. The thing that blows me away is this type of audio processing is super easy to do if you can have a delay. It's making the round trip from this microphone into my audio recording interface through my recording software. And in between me and the recording software is my GPU, my graphics card, processing that audio and putting it back out in real time. Like, I was kind of watching on Twitch for a bit. I don't think I see any noticeable separation or significant lag between my audio and my mouth moving. And yet it's able to sculpt out the air conditioner that's kicking on, the fact that my PC is making a little bit more noise than it normally does, that the leaf blowers were hovering right outside my window for a good, 20 minutes of walking up and down my condo complex. I am crazy impressed. This is magic technology to me. I really honestly never believed that we would see this kind of audio sculpting in real time. I mean, I shouldn't be as surprised as I am, but being an audio nerd, we've been promised, noise reduction technologies, and they always sound like garbage. This is working so well with intermittent noise. It's not like they just stay there. It's that they're moving around and you get these like peaks and valleys of noise. It's so crazy. It's sorcery. And so, unfortunately, while I will still get distracted and stumbly whenever they're outside my window, they will distract me. You might not always know why, because I think I'm just going to start running RTX Voice on all of my live streams now. I am so crazy impressed. From Heike, that's working miracles. From Puigi, no leaf blower sounds today. And again, I'm so happy. I'm so happy that this won't be polluting my audio streams. So I think what I'm going to be doing is, instead of taking the main real microphone record, I'm just going to pull the audio off of the live stream from now on, because it's already done that one step of audio cleaning for me that I won't have to do in post. It's insane. From Q3 Becker, I use RTX Voice on my work computer while a fan is blaring next to me because my dev console is overheating. Again, this is running my workstation a little harder. It has, the fans have been kicking up a little louder than they usually do, but again, the air conditioner just kicked on about a minute ago. And that is something that would have added just a little bit of ambiance to this mic. Whether or not you would hear it during the live stream, I would have been able to hear it during the audio version. It's not gonna show. That is insane. It just blows me away. I really feel like this is a game changer for those of us that are weekend warriors or home content creators. It's huge. Get this out of the way here. Oh, Root Knight 5. I'm sitting on an AMD GPU, so we'll see how it ends up. Again, I not like to say like, oh, well, you need to go out and spend the big bucks on some RTX. I will never tell you how to spend your money. I can say this is surprisingly effective. and I was worried it was going to be another just big dumb hype plugin, because noise reduction plugins are usually garbage if you're trying to do anything in real time. This is not garbage. This is surprisingly good. And again, some folks out there might be game to share some of the links we've seen where you probably don't need to buy an RTX card if you would also like to play with this effect. Okay, real quick, LFA sent this my way this morning too. We're both very anxiously awaiting the reveal, the shipping, the distribution on Google Pixel Buds. As audio snobs and headphone reviewers, Google's attempt at a true wireless and a follow-up to the original Pixel Buds, which I thought were garbage. I'm going to be very curious to see what Google can do in audio. Because I don't have the, you know, for as amazing as Google software is, sometimes their hardware can struggle a little bit. And also, I just don't know that they've invested in audio. You know, like it took a long time for Android phones to even be able to utilize USB audio. So I'm going to be very curious to see what these things deliver, but I really like the design, especially that the design of the earbud has this built-in arm, this little wing to help it stay lodged in your ear, that we're going to a true inner aural ear tip, not some kind of open ear design. I think that's a terrible, terrible move for an audio product like this. And so I think what my early prediction is that we're going to get one of the most technologically advanced set of true wireless earbuds. I want to know that they sound good. You know, like I was very impressed with the technology on the LG Tone Free. In public situations, in noisier conditions, I don't think they sound good. So LFA Review says, I have a set coming. This should be interesting. So I'm going to point everyone to LFA's video setting that up, and especially some of the color options too. Let me go back into screen share for that for just a second. Oso orange, clearly white, quite mint, and almost black. So I think I would want, just for the video, Oso orange. LFA, what color do you think you're landing on if you're getting a pair of these coming in? Let me know what your color accent in your ears is going to look like. I'm kind of curious. Oh, going with white. Okay. The what is it? The quite white? Yeah, clearly white. Clearly white. Sam, almost black is gray. You can't call it gray. That would be boring. Oh, I see. LFA Ruse, he wanted to match his Panda, his black and white Pixel 4. So the white, that makes sense. That makes sense. Okay, good deal. Okay, so why don't we get into some gadget chat? I've been spending the last couple days just jamming as hard as I could on content for the iPhone SE and the OnePlus 8. I feel like we should start. I think we should start with the iPhone SE, that this is the disruptor product from Apple now. Sorry, Android losers. But, I just got the low battery warning because this battery is très petite. Let me get a lightning cable because it is properly going to shut down here in just a second. Well, this goes hand in hand with my conversation on the iPhone SE, is we've got an amazing engine in a commuter car and a tiny little gas tank. So, early impressions. I shared a lot of this on the TK live stream. So, if you all caught that, I'm kind of repeating myself a little bit here. I am crazy happy, irrationally happy for a modernized, refined version of the iPhone 8. From an aesthetic perspective, I don't care about notches. Notches don't bother me. I don't care about bezels. The idea of immersive phone screen design isn't what lights me up. So I'm not telling people that they shouldn't care about that stuff. I'm just telling you that I don't. So two major factors: getting a modern chipset with a decent camera. This is like iPhone XR camera territory. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a perfectly capable shooter. But the return to Touch ID and no notch. So two major factors there. First of all, the more casual one, I know no one really seems to care about notches. Consumers buy phones regardless of whether or not the screen is disrupted. But especially on a smaller screen device, if you try to do any gaming on this, had there been any disruption in the display, like let's say they really had done an all-screen iPhone 8, and they would have had to have cut into the screen for the earpiece and the selfie camera, maybe they wanted to go with Face ID, that would have taken out a significantly larger chunk of information than an iPhone 11. And when I'm playing a game, those notches cut into the UI of the game. The game goes full screen, but iOS is still too dumb to reposition the screen to avoid that disruption. It's up to the app developers to solve Apple's horrible design strategy. So when screen space is at a minimum, when there's this tiny little screen here, I'm so glad that we haven't tried to make that the experiment. Let's put a big old ugly unibrow notch on a small on an even smaller phone than an iPhone 11. It's a little thing, but to me, I appreciate that this is just the classic iPhone 8 design. I mean, the iPhone 7, the iPhone 6. Again, anyone who's complaining about aesthetics in smartphone design, oh, well, what LG should have done is rounded off the corners or made this more aesthetically pleasing. This is the same phone we've had since the iPhone 6. Design does not matter. This is going to sell a ton. This is going to be easily one of the best-selling phones of 2020. By a ridiculous margin for individual models of phone, this phone is going to decimate most of the competition at any price point. You can't tell me that the design and the aesthetic choices are so precious and consumers are out there making these nuanced buying decisions on like millimeter, fractions of a millimeter of bezel. Nah, that is horse poop and malarkey. But the major win is the return to Touch ID. I did not like Face ID on the iPhone 10. I made a separate video on Face ID for the iPhone 10s. I feel it is a more cumbersome and less convenient solution for biometric security than a fingerprint. It could potentially be more secure, I guess. But I feel a dedicated fingerprint sensor will always be a more convenient way to try to lock down a portable gadget. For the iPhone XS, when I first got it, it required a more deliberate action to unlock the phone. Like I had to be looking at it and aware of it before it would open. And then I would still have to do that stupid swipe, the home screen swipe, even though the phone had unlocked. There was no option to take me directly to my home screen. And then on the iPhone SE, I don't have to look at it. I just push the home button and I'm home, which means as I'm pulling the phone out of my pocket, it is ready and active before I'm even consciously looking at the screen or at the display. So that's just usability, right? People can disagree with me. Maybe they like Face ID. Maybe they prop their phone up in a way where the phone can scan their face, but you still have to hit the home button swipe to get through the lock screen anyway, which is just so dumb that there's no option to bypass it. But let me tell you, Face ID has never worked with my Ray-Bans. I wear mirrored Ray-Bans when I go out in public. I like them. They've got blue tint lenses. It has always failed. It doesn't matter what setting or if I make the security less, you know, like if I reduce the security effectiveness of Face ID, people tell me I should be able to get around that. It has never worked. I always have to do my PIN on an iPhone when I'm outside. Face identification has gotten even worse now that I'm typically wearing a mask when I go outside. So on my Pixel 4, which isn't as picky about my sunglasses, it won't unlock if I'm holding the phone up and I'm wearing a hat and sunglasses and a mask. There's no face to scan because I am immunocompromised. It is a slight fraction more dangerous for me to go out in public than an average dude my age. I'm not going to reduce, my protection to make my phone unlock a little easier. So fingerprint sensors, the only way I can really get around if I need to use my phone out in public. But let me tell you guys, a dedicated hardware sensor is just so much nicer than in display. I'm being picky here, but for as much improved as the fingerprint sensors are on the OnePlus 8, on the LG V60, I still don't think Samsung fingerprint sensors, in-display fingerprint sensors are that great as a solution. They tend to take longer, and I get way more failures on in-display than on a dedicated, especially on a rear fingerprint sensor. Home button. It's just so practical. It's just so usable. And the phone is built, especially for my little hobbit hands, it's just built to fit, and it's open and it's unlocked. And the phone's pointing away from my face, and it's open and it's unlocked, and it's coming out of my pocket, and it's open and it's unlocked. And like, the failure rate drops to near zero. As opposed to, like, I'm totally exaggerating, and it's just that the failures stand out. But like, I pick up a OnePlus 8. I'm gonna do it. And that took a second. So here's I can't really. And that one works better. That one worked faster. But I'd already turned the phone on, so it was already awake. There's no guide though. So the OnePlus 8 moves the fingerprint sensor a little bit higher because the phones are taller and skinnier. And so it's in a slightly different place on screen. So if I'm coming from a OnePlus 7, I have to aim my thumb higher with no landmark or no guide to unlock the phone. And it still doesn't really work. Like, I haven't futzed with the settings enough, but it doesn't really work where if the screen is completely off, that I can just rest my thumb where I know the sensor is. So I have to alert the phone some way, and then I can unlock it. It's just, it's always like, well, here's a little extra step, and now you have to do one other little thing, or you have to wake the phone, or you have to manage the device. And it's like, that's not more convenient. That's not better. That's not an improvement. It just looks a little tech cooler, and you saved some manufacturing off of the rear of the device to make the screen assembly more more complicated. So, from Matt Tyler, I don't understand why Apple waited so long to do these phones. They would be so much better off if they did this price range every 2 years. The thing I like is that it gives us some hope that the iPhone SE will be a long-lived device. I don't know. Do I have it handy? My original iPhone SE was sold for a surprisingly long period of time. It got a refresh from the original terrible base model storage to eventually having like a 64 gig option, and then the original iPhone SE, on the same day that the new SE launched, both of these devices were updated to the same core operating system kernel. So iOS 13.4.1 still came to my OG iPhone SE. It's probably going to be one of the last major iterations of iOS that comes to that device. That gives me some hope that Apple is looking at this as a long-term support solution for $400, which again is going to be another perk. That is something worth factoring into the consideration when we look at the price and the performance of a product like this. But that's also, I'm almost out of water in this mug. Let me just finish this mug real quick. But that also means that we need to be able to have grown-up and nuanced conversations. I am not impressed with the headlines on Apple sells an iPhone that outperforms all of the expensive Androids. The most powerful chip in a phone is now in a $400 phone. That's technically true. I don't think anyone would fight me on that. But the A13, as a piece of hardware, is outperforming Snapdragon 865, especially in synthetic benchmarks. But Apple still has this humongous disconnect. They give you this crazy powerful engine, but it still they still seem to limit what developers can do with that engine. I would strongly caution anyone thinking you're going to get an iPhone SE and that it's like you're going to get the power of an iPhone 11 Pro for cheap. I would strongly caution against that being a purchasing decision for you. You are not getting an iPhone 11 for cheap. You're getting an upgraded iPhone 8. And that major consideration in my benchmarking video for the iPhone SE, that shows majorly on the battery. This is a high-end, premium, heavy-lifting, torquey, powerful chipset paired with the absolute smallest battery in any phone launched this year. While I was doing my rendering tests, I made it through about 4 minutes of UHD video rendering, and I had nuked about 30% of the battery. On that first day of reviewing, so setting up and installing apps and running some speed tests and some benchmarks and some video rendering, I got 1 hour and 15 minutes of screen on time and had killed 65% of the battery. So I was on track to do less than 2 hours of screen on time under the heaviest lifting tests that I can perform on a phone. And even my battery drain tests, like if you stream, hold on, I want to get the numbers on this right. So let me pull up my Excel spreadsheet here, with all my benchmarks and stuff. It's going to go to, the wrong window. I'm in the wrong sheet. And now let me go back to here. Okay. So I do a video streaming test, and increasingly it's kind of not worth testing the way that I used to. So it used to be I'd stream 30 minutes of HD video at a certain screen brightness and then just measure how much the battery drained. Modern, big, premium battery Android phones, it's getting almost to a point where that is not measurable. So on the OnePlus 8 Pro in HD, not in quad HD, but in 1080p, I tracked about a 2% drop in battery at the screen brightness that I consistently test at. That is closing in on margin of error. Like, that is not an accurate measurement of how much battery is drained. If you decide you want to watch a movie, 30 minutes is now becoming insufficient to gauge power draw. The iPhone SE 2020 drained 7%? Yes, 7% of its battery streaming 30 minutes of HD footage at the same screen brightness. That's a lot for a phone that's built as a streamlined, quick access notification communications phone. You're in one of those situations where, like, you know, for me, it was always like I'd be stuck at a bank or in line at a grocery store. I've got my earbuds in. So, you know, I'm going to be here for 15 minutes. Let me fire up a YouTube video, or I'll play a little bit of just kind of a casual time waster game. And you know, you don't really track the 15 minutes, but that takes a hit on your battery. On an iPhone SE, 7% of your battery to watch an episode of Community. That's kind of a big chunk for a device that's also going to have to live the rest of your day. That it's, you're relying on it to make phone calls and to engage with social media and to email and to text message. And maybe you do also buffer it with some gaming. So I did a little gaming test playing Anima which is an ARPG, and 30 minutes of Anima drained 9% of that battery. So if you're thinking like, man, I've got this powerful phone, I'm going to sit and I'm going to play games on it and I'm going to render movies and I'm going to like do all those things that an iPhone 11 can do, you are going to nuke your battery on the regular. That battery is going to wear out way faster. And you should factor in the costs of at least one battery replacement, if not two, over the full life of that phone. I'm very disappointed in a gadget reviewer community that is focused on chipset as if that is the only metric that should matter to consumers, and that they're not examining any of Apple's performance claims, right? Apple says it's the most powerful, and everyone goes, yeah, it is. Yeah, brah. But they're not saying how much more powerful. They're just going to put out an unlabeled bar graph in a keynote, and everyone's going to go, most powerful. It's the most powerful chipset. Go, Apple. You're amazing. It's not really more powerful than an 865. There is one transcode test where it absolutely smokes what Qualcomm is doing. Video rendering is neck and neck. So if you're putting together a complex project like transitions and fades and a watermark or a soundtrack, the OnePlus 8 beats the iPhone SE, and the iPhone SE ties my LG V60. So I really want that to resonate. You see up to a 50% improvement in single core synthetic benchmarks, but it ties a Snapdragon 865. Where is this indomitable lead that tech reviewers are hyping up? Because it doesn't exist. And especially if an app is decently coded for multi-core performance, Qualcomm has the win. The multi-core performance on the Snapdragon is better than the multi-core performance on the iPhone SE. So this isn't to say, you know, like, oh, I'm not digging the phone. I adore the iPhone SE. It is an amazing communicator. It is a phenomenal one-thumb navigation experience. It's a small form factor, premium built device. But I want to review it as the communicator it's really intended to be and not try and trump up completely specious performance characteristics that, again, if we're worried about average consumers, if average consumers are really tapping into this stuff, they're going to be using their phone in a way that significantly reduces the life of that device, especially the battery. So I got to move on to coffee mug of water number two. I'm sorry. I know I've been kind of monologuing here, and I've been seeing a number of comments coming in. From Sam34, I really wish the G8X and the V60 face unlock and an actual fingerprint reader like the V50. I would love to see an LG G8 return. True face unlock, rear mounted fingerprint sensor. I still think they're the best. I haven't seen anything that dissuades me from that being the only phone that offered great security. And I really wish that I could do both. I really wish I could turn on a setting on my G8 so that it would force me to face authenticate and fingerprint authenticate to get into the device. I think that would be a nice perk for the most security conscious people out there. from Matt Tyler, why the hell didn't Apple put a bigger battery in it? Because it's an iPhone 8. I mean, like, this is the genius of the iPhone SE. This is not a new device. The logic board and the camera and the internal components can be direct swaps. So people have already taken apart the iPhone SE and put in iPhone 8 components, and the phone still works. This is genius on Apple's part, especially from the business side of this. You want to know how you can still have a stupid high profitability on a $400 phone? It's because they're not playing this BS game of trying to impress us with radical design changes every year. Recycle the shell. Recycle the form factor. Consumers do not care. Consumers don't care if there's a fraction of a millimeter bezel difference on a Galaxy S20 over a Galaxy S10. They don't care. Save the money and put those R&D and development costs into the tech that matters, which is exactly what Apple has done here. But because of that, this becomes a major compromise for the phone if you are honest about talking about performance. You cannot trump up the most powerful chipset if you can only use the phone for an hour. And I want to see that. I want to see that. You know, all the people that were tweeting that out, you know, remember like how many YouTube influencers were talking this up massive. Oh, OnePlus 8 is totally dead. This completely disrupts the market. No one could possibly compete against this amazing powerhouse of a chipset. And you're like, sure. But you know what's not going to die on me in an hour, even if I'm rendering 4K video, is a Pixel 3a. Pixel 3a is going to smoke an iPhone SE for longevity. It's going to outlast that phone. I mean, like, that's not... So again, what do you care about? Do you care about a device with great radio management? You should have some concerns with Apple. Do you care about a company that has always had a great relationship with their consumers in regards to power management and battery throttling? You should have some concerns with Apple. And especially when they're putting out a new product with a smoking chipset and the absolute smallest battery capacity. But on the other side, where I was before, we should have some appreciation for the business acumen and the fact that this is going to be a well-supported device. I have zero qualms recommending this phone to most of my family and friends. They're not going to smoke this battery because they genuinely haven't changed their behavior in years. So from an iPhone 6S to an iPhone SE 2020, they're going to keep using their phones the same way. Now they just have a slightly nicer version of that. And they're going to appreciate getting a camera upgrade. Awesome. That's genius. I feel so good about recommending a $400 phone to someone in the Apple ecosystem that's brand new and purpose-built to be a great little lower mid-ranger. Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch. Oh man, I know I'm missing lots of comments here. From Dave Burns and Mr. Pulp Fiction are having a conversation with car metaphors. I'd agree. It's kind of like buying a V8 engine and disabling four cylinders to save gas. I feel like Apple could benefit from smarter power management on the iPhone SE. It to me, I think it would actually be a benefit to have an underclocked option, you know, a consumer facing, easier to explain low power mode. And it's the same criticism I had for the Pixel 4. It's not that you can't get better battery life out of a Pixel 4. It's that Google dropped the ball in communicating what settings would get you better battery life. Mm-hmm. Aditya Nil, as a wise TK Bay once said, benchmarks are not real life. Dave Bonine, are you talking to me in Show Me Your Shirt? I'm wearing my Ewoking Dead. I got that from a Loot Crate years ago. From Stan, yeah, man, on Periscope, the Yessie is everything the new Palm should have been. I would love to see a real Palm Pilot, Palm device return. Like that Palm Pebble, small form factor, single thumb design. Man, it could be really nice. We are desperate for premium small form factor devices these days. Or Dave Bow, exactly. Can we get a Pixel 2 XL with an updated SoC? I have so many phones like that. I would love to see throwback versions of older phones just with improved internal components. But moving forward, I really hope that, you know, like the V60 is the exact same form factor as the V70. How great would that be? You get the V60 this year, and if you want to flip to the V70, same case. You don't have to buy a different case. We can keep that continuity moving forward, and it saves LG on development costs, on manufacturing costs. You'd have great carryover with components, you know, like the radios and the battery. One-to-one swap. Make them a one-to-one swap. A 5,000 milliamp hour battery next year is still going to be a solid capacity for a battery next year. It just doesn't make sense to keep reinventing the wheel every year. And this is why gadgets get more expensive, development costs get more expensive, support is more difficult. Just don't do that. Apple shows you how to make more money. This is something I feel we can safely copy from Apple and not be too upset about it. Oh man, Mr. Pulp Fiction, what's Juan's favorite smartphone of all times? Yeesh. I'm going to have to save that for another podcast because we're already running crazy long. But I don't even know that I could fully encapsulate because, again, each smartphone becomes a product of its time. Let's switch gears. So iPhone SE, I'm going to be having more coverage coming out. It's taken a really long time to get the battery from almost dead to just, you know, like 40%. This is going to get a positive review. No one was going to be surprised by that. I am incredibly excited to see a return to the SE philosophy from both a business perspective and from a consumer-facing perspective. I have so many friends and family that I will be excited to offer this as an alternative to an iPhone 11. I know people who won't care about OLED screens and pixel-dense displays and multiple camera arrays that are going to pick this phone up, and it's going to be like wrapping themselves in a warm blanket. Immediately familiar, right? They won't have to change one iota of their smartphone use to pick up this phone and just get on with their day. So that to me becomes just the stunning victory of what Apple has achieved at $400 with this phone. I really can't say enough nice things about it. And what coverage I produce for iOS, this is going to be my daily driver now. I do not enjoy the experience on my iPhone XS. I opted not to buy an iPhone 11. I kind of borrowed an iPhone 11 Pro just to kind of complete some of my coverage from Apple at the end of last year. This is going to be my jam. And this combination, my Apple Watch Series 4 and my iPhone SE, it's like throwback, it's classic, it's old school. it doesn't feel bleeding edge, and yet I feel like this is a more productive and a better bang for buck daily computing combination than shopping at the high end of what Apple has to offer. So it's getting a positive review, but I know a lot of people are going to bristle because I have a lot of criticisms of the tech coverage surrounding the iPhone SE. And I feel like we're seeing conversations in bad faith. We're seeing people really try and promote this as something that it's not, and that it's going to win them arguments on the internet, and it's going to get them better YouTube ad revenue, but it's not really a it's not really a beneficial review or tech discussion. And that I think is kind of a bummer. From Aditi Anil, you just described my folks. I said this on the Android Central podcast, but I've held this up as an example. I even did an editorial on why do tech reviewers hate their grandmothers so much. But if I have to have a conversation with my grandmother about buying a new phone, she's on an iPhone 7 right now. I use this gimmick, but it works. You know, it makes sense. Like, hey, Nana, so you need to get a new iPhone. The iPhone 11, they got rid of the home button. So now you've got to swipe from the tiny bottom edge of a super slippery glass display. And if you don't nail it just perfect, like if you don't nail the swipe exactly the way that Apple wants you to do it, then you won't go home. And if you hold too long at the top of that swipe, it's going to pull up all of the other apps that are running on your phone. So you've got to perfectly swipe to go home. No, I know. The bottom swipe used to be where your settings were. So you got used to just swiping up from the bottom and then all these settings would pop up. That's now at the top of the screen. Oh, I know what you mean. Because at the top of the screen, you used to have notifications. So now if you swipe from one part of the top of the screen, you get notifications. And you swipe from the other part of the top of the screen, you get your settings. So the settings that were super easy to swipe that aren't as mission critical as the home button, that's now split at the top. And again, if you miss the top of the screen off the notch, then you'll just get the search. So you've got three different actions for top swipes, and the new camera also has a new top swipe. So the little carrot also changes what you see. And you see, if I miss the carrot just a little bit, it pulls down that little tab to get a different swipe action. So now there's technically five different top swipe mechanics at the top edge of your screen, and the home button causes you to, with your arthritic hands, because you have arthritis, to move the phone in your hand to get that bottom edge swipe to go back home again. And now I don't have to say that to my grandmother. I can just say, hey, pick up an iPhone SE. It's going to be exactly the same as their iPhone 7, and it's going to be better. Exactly the same. One-to-one replacement. Literally, you can use the same case. And again, I cannot say enough nice things about the iPhone SE 2020. That makes me so happy. Aditya Anil. Wait, what you're saying is giving me a headache. Dave Burns, I think I just had an aneurysm. Gary the Fireman, Steve Jobs is laughing at us. Vazikos 8, forget Nana, I can't do that. All right, we're running crazy long, and we're going to be running crazy long because we've got to talk about OnePlus 8. OnePlus 8 and OnePlus 8 Pro. Like I said, I'm crazy late to this review conversation, and the phones officially go public and go live for availability on April 29th. But I've been tracking benchmarks and performance and battery life and all of those specs that I try and cover in my reviews. So I think tomorrow I'm going to try and have a video out for the Patreon, the first officially branded By the Benchmarks review series. And then that should go public. I want to put it out public on the 29th when you can actually pick up the phones in different regions. OnePlus was kind enough to send these out. These are proper review devices. I didn't have to go and buy them. But, you know, I'm in on the last part of the early review window for the OnePlus 8 in the really pretty, super flashy Aura Glow. I don't remember what they're calling this, but it's literally a different color with every minute angle change as it hits the lighting. It's a really stunning effect. And then, so this is the upgraded. This is the 256 gig, 12 gigabytes of RAM, OnePlus 8. And then they also sent over the base model OnePlus 8 Pro. So the OnePlus 8 Pro I'm going to look at is the 128 gigabyte model with 8 gigabytes of RAM, which represents like $100 price difference between these two phones. So I think it's going to be an interesting piece of commentary to talk about screen resolution, a slight battery bump, different camera modules. But it's a very different solution than what we had last year with the OnePlus 7 and the OnePlus 7 Pro. Where I felt like the OnePlus 7 Pro offered more direct improvements to the actual performance of the device. I think the OnePlus 8 Pro is mostly offering convenient for lifestyle features as improvements, the higher resolution and faster refresh rate on the display, and the much improved camera sensor. One of the things I'm going to be really excited to jump into coming in a little late on the OnePlus is the early videos for the OnePlus 8 Pro. I was very disappointed that people were as upset about some of the software bugs as they were. I feel like this is a known entity on OnePlus phones. I have had these phones since, what, since Wednesday of last week? Like, I actually took them out of the box Wednesday night. It was like the day before I got my iPhone SE. I have gotten, it came, like there was already a major software patch, and then I have gotten two more software patches since I fired the phones up. And they're not like little bug fixy patches. I mean, we're talking 2 and 400 megabyte downloads addressing screen performance, adjusting touch response, adjusting audio performance, camera focusing. Any video that you've seen on a OnePlus 8 from that initial embargo window, this is now a different phone from that first batch of videos. So the conversation on OnePlus has always been one of the most aggressive moving targets in tech. The first year of a OnePlus's life cycle is very difficult to pin down. The software updates change the feel of this phone dramatically over the first 6 months. And I feel like that always needs to be a significant talking point on OnePlus. But even with these, now, like I'm saying, three software updates in, this new main camera sensor is absolutely stunning. So I've got the script written for my LG V60 camera review. I'm immediately jumping in to start shooting samples for my OnePlus 8. And I think I'm going to, I don't think I can tag team them. Like, it's the performance is so different. When we make jokes about, you know, how cameras are more than just the megapixels, seeing a 48 megapixel main sensor on the OnePlus 8 and a 48 megapixel sensor on the OnePlus 8 Pro, they really couldn't be more different if you tried. Low light performance, the texture and quality of the focus fall off, the background blur, the bokeh, the natural bokeh. This new 48 megapixel sensor is a supremely competitive piece of camera tech. I mean, like, I don't miss not having, I don't miss 8K recording. Like, it wasn't something I was going to do a whole lot of on my V60, but this showdown is going to be pretty epic. The LG camera sensor is much improved over those 12 megapixel shooters we used to have. The new 64, million pixels is a phenomenal adaptation. I think in just core standard auto mode photography, even for how futzy and how odd some of OnePlus's processing decisions can be, man, the photos are looking so good. I mean, like, I haven't moved any of them off of the phone yet because I've been so rapidly trying to get through my sort of normal review setup. So, I mean, I can't even show you like what a standard, I got too much glare, like a standard photo, is this the, to a night mode, it still looks a little cartoonishly HDR, but I mean, like, the detail, clarity, capture, the balancing of highlights and lowlights, I'm backlit from a street lamp, it's color processing my skin tones correctly, and it's so fluid. I mean, what would normally be kind of like a 6 to 8 second exposure on a Pixel 4 was like a 2 second snap, like a 2 to 3 second long exposure on the OnePlus 8 Pro. OnePlus's camera software is always going to be a bit of a stumble, but their hardware has gotten so good. And I don't think that that's going to get enough credit because it's the expensive OnePlus. And who would ever buy a $900 OnePlus, gasp, clutching of pearls, gnashing of teeth? This new sensor is legit. It's another increase to sensor size. It explains why the camera module on the back of the phone is so comically large and protruding from the back of the phone. I was always going to recommend picking up some kind of a case. And I have to say, for this sort of like blue teal look, that the cyan case takes me right back to my Lumia days. And I like sandstone. I know I'm kind of, you know, kind of alone there, but I miss when sandstone was just built into the backs of the phones, because it's grippy. It's got a great texture. It feels really nice in the hand. So this combination, where the camera doesn't, I mean, it lines up kind of flush with the protective edge on the back of the case, but you know, that's going to be how this phone lives in a case anyway. I'm not going to take it out in public naked. I'm not seeing where OnePlus has stumbled here. We know phones were getting more expensive. Component pricing and licensing and carrier agreements in the US caused a steep increase in phone prices. But if I had to compare a $999 OnePlus 8 Pro to a $999 base model Galaxy S20, I'd take the 8 Pro. The triple camera is a more conventional and I think a better featured triple camera. Samsung is definitely going to have the edge for software, for camera software. Quad HD at 120 frames per second, twice as much starting storage. What is it? 4 gigabytes more RAM, fast battery charging, reverse wireless charging. These things that Samsung has been touting, like $999 to $999. I don't think the Galaxy is a foregone conclusion. Like, that's amazing competition. And that's exactly the kind of position we should see for the premium end of the OnePlus lineup. And then you take it down to the OnePlus 8, with one of the lowest starting prices for a Snapdragon 865. And I see where this is reasonable competition against devices that are going to be several hundred dollars more expensive. So I'm also looking at trying to do kind of a gimmicky comparison. I don't really think comparisons are really that informative anymore, but they're fun to kind of get people like lit up, you know, to get like dopey, geeky, nerdy arguments happening. And I got to fit an LG V60 in between the OnePlus 8 and the OnePlus 8 Pro. Like, such different smartphone design philosophies. A huge difference on, like, smartphone hardware over, you know, smartphone software. You know, OnePlus easily takes the win for UI software. Like, that's no competition. But LG has a ton of software built into all of the different features that they have to support in their hardware. I mean, it's just crazy. To me, it's like you could not find two more different companies to compete, except for maybe like Apple. But I have to play with something kind of silly at that point. But my early impressions on these OnePluses, the OnePlus 8, if you're really talking about the absolute fastest knife fighter kart racer in the Android ecosystem right now, it's the OnePlus 8. The OnePlus 8 Pro actually takes a backseat to a number of my benchmarks. The 8 Pro takes the backseat to the OnePlus 8 in a number of my benchmarks. And performance is very close to the V60. And the V60 loses by just a little bit in almost every test that I can throw at it against the regular OnePlus 8. So if it's all about speed, the OnePlus 8 represents, I think, the much higher margin bang for buck. If you want to delve into more premium lifestyle features like beautiful displays, you want that extra peace of mind for water resistance, and you care about camera performance, the OnePlus 8 Pro is surprising me in ways that previous OnePluses haven't. From the OnePlus 5 to the OnePlus 6, my early commentary was very similar to what it was over a Pocket Now. Out of the box, on week one, pre-embargo software, this is not good performance for the camera. And then months later, it got way better. Two software patches into the OnePlus 8 Pro, and I've got an auto mode shooter, which, for the first time, I think in a while, I mean, at least, you know, outside of Huawei, I'm feeling some of those, you know, like photography, good feelings, good vibrations that I would throw back to like a phone like the Lumia 1020. Sensor size advantage, some smarter compression algorithms to shrink the final file size. So it's not a full 48 megapixel image. It's a 12 megapixel still. And how quickly it processes through that content opposite a phone like the Pixel 4, where I still think Google's camera software is superior, but you can bog down a Pixel 4 if you rapidly snap through a burst of photos. The sensor size advantage on the OnePlus 8 Pro does a very good job of nullifying some of the software advantages on a Pixel 4. It is not a simple oranges to oranges comparison. And anyone who's just out there like, well, I mean, like this is garbage and it's not performing like I expect it to. And I've used the phone for 48 hours because I got it during an early embargo. And that's the review. You've completely missed what a OnePlus can do. Because in another couple weeks, we're going to have another handful of updates because OnePlus is a moving target. And it's going to be even better than what I'm experiencing today. It's just, it's very encouraging. I think on that, we should probably start wrapping this up. Unless there are any other questions, I'm going to start kind of going through some of my spiel. Matt Tyler, OnePlus 8 is not good, but why? Because it's not Apple or Samsung. Shrug emoji. Mm-hmm. from Vazicos 8, the biggest problem of OnePlus 8 is the 7T. On the other hand, OnePlus 8 Pro is a winner, IMO. Yes. That is going to be another nuanced part of this conversation because nothing like the OnePlus 7T did not just suddenly become a no-go. I think this is going to be kind of broken up by region. If you are concerned about staying on the leading edge of smartphone tech, I think there's a very good argument to be made for stepping up to the OnePlus 8. One, you're just going to be at the beginning of the support lifecycle. Two, you will have a more powerful chipset, which is easily demonstrated in some heavy lifting benchmarks. I mean, like, we're closing in on PC-grade performance for things like file compression benches, where ARM has typically lagged. That got a big shot in the arm this year. You'll be coming at this fresh with, you know, sort of the newest implementation of OnePlus aesthetic methodology. You'll be first in line for this next year of support, especially as we get Android 11. It's going to come to the OnePlus 8s first and then filter to the 7s and the 6s. And then if you're in a market where you might envision getting 5G in the next 2 years, this becomes a much better buy, in my opinion, than the 7T, even at reduced costs. We can be pretty confident that carriers are going to be redirecting how their networks manage traffic to 5G solutions. You can be a little ahead of the curve, or if you're in a market where you already have it, jump on it. But that will come with a price premium. A couple $100 ain't nothing to sneeze at. But if you can weather the price increase and those criteria line up with your needs, then I think the OnePlus 8 can make an argument over the OnePlus 7T. If you're in a more rural area, 7T is such a bargain. let me just get through a couple more of these comments and then we'll wrap this up. Hashtag some OnePlus shill guy from Dave Burns. Blue Malicious, like I said before, do they not know you wanted the true blue version? Blue phones are always the correct answer, but I will give them some props for cyan case. Again, like Nokia cyan. Okay, at least they got that part right. I love this sandstone case, and I love that the sandstone case comes in a color this year. From Muppinish, are you going to review the Astro Slider when it comes out? I hope I can. This has been a pretty busy review year for me. I mean, remember, I'm one guy, so it takes me a while to chew through this stuff, and I'm still trying to produce audio content on the side too, but I want to. I really want to check out Astro Slider. From Heike, when will the V60 camera review be out? I do not have a deadline for that. I'm thinking early next week. The script is written. It's long. And I've got to sit down and shoot it all and then drop in the clips. And I've done a terrible job of updating the Patreon folder. I keep all of the sample shots that I use in my review so people can see the full resolution images. I haven't even uploaded those yet. So V60 is getting there, but I'm thinking it's still going to take me a piecemeal about a week to finish off that video in light of everything else that I'm trying to cover at the same time. From Dave Burns, I like how the circular camera module died really hard. Again, Opal and BBK, there's a parts bin there, and OnePlus's design on the 7T was maybe a little too extravagant to keep up with for future OnePluses. I missed it because I liked that Lumia Oreo disc. I thought that looked sharp, but yeah, they've gotten to something a little bit more normalized, and that probably helped them rein in costs. From Goran Petrovic, I'm still waiting for an Xperia 5 Mark II to appear, and Juan will forget the SE instantly. And that's another one, too. I'm reaching out to my Sony contacts. I really want to make sure I review at least one Xperia this year. The Xperia 1 Mark II looks like it will be the one true no-compromises device. The highest resolution display, headphone jack, stereo speakers, multi-camera array, true manual mode controls. The 1 Mark II, I think, above and beyond, will be the monster, everything in the kitchen sink phone, even above what Samsung can kind of tack on there too. From Muppinish, last question for me. Do you have any direct donation like PayPal? I used to run a PayPal link. I actually haven't set something like that up in a while. If there are any, if there's anyone out there, you've got, a recommendation. Like I know Viper does, what is it? Buy me a coffee. I mean, if there's a way that you would want to contribute there, I totally appreciate that folks don't always like doing business with companies like Patreon. But I will say, if you want to kick in a buck or two and you're philosophically okay with doing business with Patreon, I think $2 is probably the best bang for buck, where a $2 contribution on Patreon gets you a month of access to all of my paywalled content. And also gets you access to the Some Gadget Guy Discord. I gotta say, the group that we've got in that Discord is just genuinely a phenomenal group of tech pals. The Patreon's great too. We get some great conversations happening on the actual Patreon posts and in the comments. But that Discord is like, I live out of that Discord now. It is such a good group, so encouraging. We've been looking out for each other. Been trying to do a bit more, you know, like live calling and just checking in. It's been a big help, psychologically and practically. So, if people have recommendations, please send them my way. But I will promote my own Patreon as being that good community. Access buy-in might make the most sense for your gadget dollar, is what I'm saying. From Stan, yeah, man, thoughts on the LG Velvet. I was considering a V60, but curious about the new device. I'm going to hold off on that. We do have news that coming up in May, we're going to have the official launch for the Velvet. And so I've talked about it on previous episodes just from the leaks and rumors and the teaser video, but we'll follow up on that in the coming weeks. And I think that's going to wrap us up. Yeah, Goran Petrovic saying June launch with a May reveal is our latest information. So, for the Xperia. So, let me get this knee bent over here. So, crazy long. We got to wrap this up. These episodes are chock full of interaction and participation and communication. So, I have to put out my weekly thank you to this community. Joining me every week, every Monday morning, especially knowing that I kind of hit a ton of podcasting over this last week. And I hope you do check out some of these streams and some of these shows that I'm talking about, the Creator Chat with Jason Howell, my sit down with Daniel over at Android Central. Just how much I enjoyed getting to have a chill conversation with someone like Daniel. Again, it means a lot when you have a chat with someone who's as thoughtful as Daniel is. And then TK, doing 4 hours of streaming with TK. The fact that so many of you are along for the ride is just, it means a lot. And words are always going to be insufficient to properly express how much I value those contributions and how much I value this participation. But above and beyond, and for why I love to preach this to this choir, is you probably won't always get the kudos or the thank yous from your family and friends that you deserve. Right now, in a society that is afraid, that is anxious, and is relying on their tech like never before, you are likely getting tapped for your knowledge and for your expertise more than we have in a while. You know, like, consumers felt pretty good. They could ignore us nerds out on the periphery of talking about gadgets. They're going to whinge on about things that we don't really care about. But, man, I've got aunts and uncles that are asking about gaming headsets. My grandparents are on Zoom and FaceTime and Google Duo. And I'm sure, I have every confidence that so many of you, without even blinking, without even thinking about it, have risen to this occasion to be the resources for your family and friends, the amazing resources that I know you can be. And I would like to highlight that at the end of this podcast. And I would like to talk about that at the end of this podcast, because I'm sure some of that's probably been taken for granted. Not even realizing that the amount of effort and energy and research that you've done to help them out was something that they got to benefit from. Oh, cool. Yeah, I asked about a gaming headset and you sent me a couple links. Super cool. Thanks for that. Yeah, words are insufficient, but I can't tell you how appreciative I am of you folks out there making a difference in your circles of family and friends, in your communities, and globally, where I see it every day on the regular. Someone asks for help, and it's folks like you in this live chat who are there to help. You might talk a little trash along the way, but you are there to help. So if you don't get those kudos from your family, or you don't get those kudos from your friends or from your coworkers who are going through some of these struggles and transitions too, thank you. Thank you for being a good tech neighbor. Thank you for being a good tech citizen. Mr. Rogers said, always look for the helpers whenever scary things happen. And I'm looking at a live chat full of helpers. So folks, I want you to have a phenomenal week with your technology. I want you to continue doing awesome with your tech. I want you to continue being awesome with your tech. And I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the terribly named SDGQA podcast channel. Over the next week, if you want to catch me around the web on the social medias, you can, as at Some Gadget Guy. But stay safe out there. Be well. Take care of yourselves. I'll catch you back here next week. And I just want to hold for 1 second here, because the leaf blower is right outside my window. And that's like magic to me. I love you all. I'll catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs, is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.